my instinct to arrive in the first place. So I apologize for that. I also, because we had this thing free, decided to move the kind of briefing sessions of the green paper earlier, because we have another problem, and that is that the time that we were allocated in March is now rapidly dwindling. We were given the whole first week of March to sit without any plenary sessions. I've now been told that most of those afternoons now have plenary sessions in the first week of March. So this has created huge pressure on our program. I was hoping to finish these, because we'll have a whole week, 5 days we could do it. I was hoping that we'd be able to get through the bulk of the submissions and then just have a little bit more time. And then we'll have some time to actually discuss it in March and draft a report. Now we're under huge pressure. We've received almost 40 submissions. It seems that all of them except one wants to grace themselves in front of this committee, which is good. But what that means is now we've got huge problems, because I've now set up the program for about 4 submissions every morning, about 45 minutes each, which is quite short, but I mean, we can't do anything else, with an input of 10 minutes and then the rest of the 45 minutes being spent on questions. And that already takes us to the 18th of March. We're going to have to sit every Tuesday morning, every Wednesday morning, and every Friday morning until the 18th, if we don't to finish it. I've also told Chileka we're not taking any further submissions for oral presentation. The deadline was the 15th. But what we will do, if more submissions come in, we will, of course, circulate them. But I've closed the oral submissions. You will today, hopefully, it's all being sorted out, you will get your package of submissions plus the program for the way I've allocated the 4 people a day, or 4 people a half day, really, to come and make their submissions. Towards the end, we pack in a few more. So just to say that that is where we are with the program. We've received many more submissions than I anticipated. And secondly, the program of Parliament has just changed overnight, and we've lost a lot of time and space. So please just, can you bear some understanding? Particularly on the Friday sittings, I just could not put it anywhere else. If we had to take away those, we would go into April with the hearings, and that would not be acceptable for any of us. So those will be circulated to you today, hopefully. Chileka's made copies already, and we'll. Now, today, tomorrow, and Thursday, you know that this week has also just suddenly changed. There's now a sitting this afternoon, whereas we were going to have the whole day today for the green paper. We've now had to do away with the afternoon, but we've got the whole Thursday free. There's no caucuses apparently on Thursday. You have got one. Okay, well, that makes it even more difficult. Okay, so. But you guys can just, those are quick caucuses. 3 or 4 of you can just quickly, you can do it while you're in the lift going up. Okay, no, then we must respect that. So we don't have Thursday morning, but we have then Thursday afternoon available. So what we're going to do is this. I've got 2 scientists who are going to come tomorrow to give us that kind of scientific evidence of climate change, which I was hoping is, although I've seen another paper which kind of disputes a whole lot of it, so I thought this is going to be indisputable and was going to be kind of nice and clean, and we're just going to get, well, scientists are worse than lawyers. Lawyers have at least 2 opinions, scientists have 3. So what we're going to do today, we're going to start with the green paper. If we can get through it, explaining for us chunk for chunk for chunk for chunk, and we'll ask questions as we go along if you want clarity and so on. And I want to go with that till we're finished. If we can do it today, which I doubt because it's a long paper, we'll do that. Then tomorrow we'll have the two scientists, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Midgley, I think it is. One is of Sunday, and one is at UCT, the institute. They can just enjoy themselves while they're in. And then on Thursday afternoon now, we'll obviously then finish whatever we have to finish. By Thursday, we have to be through the green paper and the scientific stuff. So that next Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday is the AWEPA conference. The Monday I've made voluntary. It's to go to two interesting sites where they do kind of environmental friendly things. I would recommend if people can go there, but I've made it voluntary because Monday is a party day and it's difficult to get people to be. But then the Tuesday and Wednesday we'll go to the conference, the AWEPA conference. That'll give us a good basis. And then Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock we kick off with the submissions. 4 on Thursday, 4 on Friday, and for the rest of the week. So I hope that gives you some idea, and that'll take us to the 18th, Friday the 18th, all the submissions, and then the week after that we'll start discussing the submissions that we've received. Anyone has any issues to raise? I'm going to give you the written stuff as soon as we fixed it up, but anyone want to raise something? Mr. Morgan?
Thanks. Thanks for those comments. I'm sure some people would like 45-minute submissions, but I also think other people wouldn't. And I just want to know whether, in fact, we're kind of allowing 45, or whether we actually are asking people how long they need, because we could probably get through it a bit quicker. I know at least two of the stakeholders that sent to the committee copied me in, and I thought they were relatively short submissions, actually, that wouldn't probably take, quite frankly, more than 15 minutes to present. So we might be able to actually get through quicker.
I'm only giving them 10 minutes to present.
Okay.
The rest of the time will be for questions and answers. So if we don't have questions and they don't have answers,
okay,
then that will go quicker. But I'm only giving 10 minutes. You know, I'm saying to people, you've given it well in advance. People must read on each. You must read the submission. So we take the submission as read, and then I've asked them to only make the major points of their submission. Of course, we can ask questions on the whole submission, but for 10 minutes, we're just going to take a 10-minute input. So that's why it's a bit difficult to anticipate.
I think we can do more in a day, even 6 a day.
Well, let's try and see how we go, and if it does. Let's see the first day, and if it does, we can start trying to see if people are prepared to move and we can rearrange some of the things. I'm quite happy if we can do it quicker, because we've really been messed up now that Parliament program has changed. But equally, in fairness, I think 45 minutes already is quite short for a serious input. But at least if we stick to the major issues, and particularly later on, if you come to week 2 and 3, the things start crystallizing. And there's one or two issues or three issues that are there. But let's see how it goes, and we'll adapt if we have to adapt. Any other issues? Okay. You'll get all the documentation today. Then I want to say to the department, thank you for, on short notice, being here. The DG, and I see your DDG have asked not to be here today. They've told me that the people who are actually the experts, I'm assuming they're the administrators, the people who are actually the experts are here today. So we're going to now listen to the actual experts in the department on the climate change issues. And, of course, we understand that the DG and DDG are not here. I'm not too sure how we're going to do this. I'm going to let you start, and I'm probably going to stop you at certain stages to see if people have questions, and we'll move on again. And obviously, if you want to come back later with a question, that's fine. So you don't have to ask all the questions now, but we'll see how we go. So we can take it in chunks, and that it's more understandable.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Lisa McCourt. I am the Chief Operating Officer of the Department. Let me just introduce the team to you. Mr. Peter Lukey, who's right at the extreme, sitting at my extreme right, is the Acting DDG for Climate Change. Ms. Joanne Yawich actually left the employment of the department. Their last day was the 21st. Of February.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah.
I knew she was going, but I didn't know it was so soon.
So Mr. Lukey is actually the acting DDG for climate change, but he's also been on the team for quite some time. Next to him is Dr. Guy Mitchley from SANBI, who's also part of the team, but also the scientist that you will be listening to tomorrow. You know Mr. Modisi, he's our chief or our departmental communications head, and then Dr. Sylvester. I always forget your name. Pandele, who is our adaptation special advisor. So Peter is a specialist in the mitigation area and Sylvester in the adaptation area. And I think Peter has also headed up the green policy process with a green paper process with Joanne. So I think we can hand over to you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair, honourable members. With your permission, Chair, We've submitted three presentations, and the first one is a very short one called the Second National Communication, which basically provides the context for the policy. Basically, this is why do we actually need a policy, and it starts speaking to some of the science, and which obviously Dr. Midgley will go into more detail tomorrow. I'm going to miss out a whole bunch of the early slides around what the Second National Communication is, but just get stuck into the key findings of the Second National Communication, which are important. The national communication was published at the same time as the Green Paper to provide a reference work of the science around climate change and the most recent scientific findings.
Have a copy of it?
You have indeed. It's in, if you look in the documents in front of you.
Not the inputs, but the actual documents.
In the folder, you will have the executive summary, and you will have a disk with an electronic copy of the full document. It's 225 pages long, Chair.
Sorry, let me just try and get it to know what I'm...
The one that
has
the
clear case
for immediate...
Oh, yeah, this one. All right. All right.
Okay.
Now we'll have noticed.
Okay.
Is this one here? None of you have noticed except me. All right, go ahead.
In terms of the key findings, and this is a really very much a summary of the summary, as you see, I mean, it's on the CD-ROM that has been provided to you, so you have an electronic version of the full draft, which is, to be honest, is actually really, really interesting reading, and it's worthwhile just scanning through. And especially if you have an area, have an interest in a certain sector, taking the CD and just doing a word search, for instance, on agriculture or education, what have you, will give some very, very good insights into the most recent South African science and the issues. But in terms of the key findings, in terms of the vulnerability of South Africa to climate change, I think perhaps before I go into this, let's just do one quick climate change 101 situation. We had a situation, a couple of years ago, we referred to climate change as global warming. And it's still the same situation. I mean, the basis of this is exactly the same. The burning of fossil fuels has increased global carbon concentrations, which has basically formed a layer in the outer atmosphere, which allows sunlight in, it bounces off the Earth, hits this layer, and bounces back. So it's like a greenhouse. A greenhouse is designed exactly the same way. If you build a greenhouse for vegetables, it allows sun in, it bounces back, hits the glass, and then bounces back in, and it warms the greenhouse to keep it at a temperature that you can grow vegetables in. Through the release of carbon dioxide into the air and the increase of the concentration of the carbon dioxide, we have basically caused a greenhouse. And it's not just a case of warming, it's basically an entire change to the climate system. And so this is what this is about. It's a national, it's a thing of international, global significance, and it affects everybody. In terms of our own vulnerability, it says the socioeconomic factors that increase South Africa's vulnerability to climate change. We have a large population of proportion of South African population has low resilience to extreme climate events due to poverty, high disease burden, inadequate housing and infrastructure, and their location. Many people are actually being housed in areas above 100-year flood lines and so on and so forth. So they're vulnerable. If there are floods, then they're vulnerable. Much of South Africa has already got low and variable rainfall. We're a water-poor country, so any major changes to our rainfall patterns have a dramatic impact on us. A significant proportion of our surface water resources are already fully allocated. So in other words, in areas where we actually have water, that water is fully allocated. There's no spare water. And agriculture and fishery is important from a food security point of view, and of course from a subsistence point of view. I mean, people that actually live from the land, any change in their ability to live from the land, of course, has a massive impact on their lives. In terms of the key findings, this illustration shows that surface air temperatures have been warming significantly over much of South Africa since the 1950s. And this is based on information from measurements across the country. And as you can see from these little red dots, those are the areas that show that there's a significant positive trend in temperature, which is, in other words, this is not predicted, this is actually measured right now. So there's a trend in positive in our temperatures. In terms of looking at the models around what this means, if these trends continue, under relatively unmitigated global emission scenarios, in other words, if, for instance, we don't have an international agreement and we continue to grow our carbon emissions, we are likely to suffer some dramatic impacts. And it's modeled that, for instance, in terms of the coastal regions, those coastal regions will warm by 1 to 2 degrees in 2050, or 3 to 4 degrees by 2100. The interior regions are worse off because the actual sea causes a bit of a buffer to temperature. So internally, when you go into the interior, it's even worse. So, for instance, in Johannesburg and 2100, if nothing changes, the temperatures will increase from 6 to 7 degrees. Now this, 6 to 7 degrees, well, so what? This makes areas of the country unlivable. It's as simple as that. The whole aspect, for instance, if you've seen massive deaths of older people due to heat strokes and what have you, because temperatures have increased 5 or 6 degrees above the normal average, gives you an indication of what this is all about. This is really, really serious stuff. In terms of rainfall patterns, these pictures show in the top low row the upper 75% of the models that show that there is a potential for slight increases in rainfall patterns on the eastern side of the country. But the reality is the western side of the country, which is already exceptionally dry, does not show any increase. In fact, it's the other way around. In terms of stream flow, we see from the models that have been done that stream flows on the western side of the country are reduced. Increased heats, increased evaporation, no changes in rainfall patterns means that, for instance, that the actual stream flow is reduced. In terms of water resources, these show two maps, the current situation 2000 and what is likely to happen by 2025 under these scenarios. And you can see that, for instance, any areas where we actually have a slight surplus are reduced, and the areas that are now in balance may actually become a situation where we have a shortage. Some of the other key impacts: the agricultural subsectors are sensitive to projected climate change. There are winners and losers. Under the winners and losers aspect as well, one of the things that increased carbon in the atmosphere does is it acts like a fertilizer. Because as you know, plants absorb carbon in photosynthesis. And so with increased carbon, there is a sort of situation where there's a fertilizer effect. And as a result of that, on the eastern side of the country, we've seen increased bushification of the land. So where we had open grazing areas, now we're starting to get quite dense bush. And of course, the implication on the one side, that sounds fantastic, but on the other side, it actually means a terrible thing for stock farmers, for example. They lose rangeland and pasture. Small-scale and homestead dryland farmers are most vulnerable, naturally. Intensive irrigated agriculture is better buffered, because, of course, it's quite well managed and controlled. But it's vulnerable to water resource constraints, obviously. Under some scenarios, maize production in summer rainfall areas and fruit and cereal production in winter rainfall areas is likely to be significantly adversely affected. The whole sort of horror stories are, for instance, the end of winemaking in the Western Cape and these sort of things. These are things that are really, that we can look at. Commercial forestry is vulnerable to increased frequency of wildfires and restriction due to their high water demand. Just imagine this. I mean, as it becomes hotter, evaporation increases. Things just simply become drier. And as you see in the Western Cape, the typical example is that when the felt becomes dry, it's a tinderbox. And the felt fires are normally hot, and they're frequent. So as our atmosphere gets drier, it starts drying things out. Our soil gets drier, and so on and so forth. One of the greatest losses that was pointed out by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change from the Western Cape's point of view is we are a country that houses the smallest plant kingdom, flameboards. It's the only plant kingdom that is contained in the borders of one country, so, which is quite dramatic. And the potential of the destruction of flameboards is dramatic, with figures of around 80% of species being lost and what have you, which means that the iconic fynbos, the smallest plant kingdom in the world, the only plant kingdom that is contained within the boundaries of a country, is likely to become extinct. That alone is such a disturbing finding if we don't start finding proper solutions to this. Alien invasive plant species are likely to increase, and this is not surprising either. In terms of the various of the predictions that are made, if things go on the way they are, 60% of the country will be experiencing climate that is unknown in South Africa today. So if the climate is completely unknown in South Africa today, then, for instance, the plant species within that climate will change. And so the chances of exotic species really taking over in certain areas, of course, are hugely dramatic. But then, of course, one has to ask the question, is that what becomes an exotic species? Under the new climate regime, perhaps the exotic species is now the indigenous species. And so even in that sort of situation about how our felt looks and the type of biodiversity we have in the country has big question marks against it. Strong trends have been detected in the physical marine environment, rising sea levels, of course, warming Agulhas currents and parts of Benguela. But projections of what will happen in the sea, which of course is massive and also is an absorption, is an area that absorbs temperature as well and buffers temperature, remains quite speculative. It's an area of our science that we probably need a lot more work on. Health impacts are exacerbated by a disease burden complex. I mean, at the moment, we already have a very high disease burden. Climate change does not help that at all. It just really makes it worse. Some effects due to climate change may already be occurring, such as drought and floods and temperature extremes, extreme weather events. We've seen these things. Cholera outbreaks have been associated with extreme weather events, especially in poor, high-density settlements, so aspects of floods and droughts and what have you. I think it's important to mention, Chair, at this point, that it is not possible to blame any specific events on climate change. So if, for instance, you have floods in an area, you can't just say, well, climate change caused this. What you can say is that the chance of that event, that type of event increasing and increasing in intensity as a result of climate change is possible. Floods happen. Whether we have climate change or not, floods happen. But the intensity of those floods and the increase in the time that it actually happens, and that you can blame on climate change. And so it's one thing that's normally the difficulty with the press is that they would throw out the farmers to say, there's been a flood somewhere in the Eastern Cape. Is that climate change? The answer always is, no, it's not. It's a flood. However, those kind of events may increase with climate change. Damage costs due to extreme weather-related events, flooding, fire, storms, and droughts, have been conservatively and roughly estimated at $1 billion a year. And this is a real photograph. I mean, these are houses on the coast, and this is a storm surge. And you can imagine, with an extra increase in sea level, spike up the centimeters, you can say goodbye to those particular houses. So that, in a nutshell, are the kind of key findings of the second national communication. As I said, it's like a complete summary of the summary. You've got the executive summary in your packs, and you've got the full document on the CD-ROM.
There's a lot of questions that arise, but I'm going to... Any questions? Any issues you want to take up? I think one thing you'll have to make me understand, if you give an input like this, and bearing in mind your comments towards the end, that one cannot pinpoint any specific events on climate change, which is obvious to me in any case. But the consequences you spell out are also obvious to me. But what is interesting to me, when you say the heat, the temperature has risen from 1950 in South Africa and so on, obviously the obvious question is, with the ecology all interlinked, to what extent would those increases be because of what we do in South Africa, or because of the abuses we have in the world in general? I mean, is there a way to pinpoint that? I mean, particularly Africa. I mean, the whole of Africa has very little emissions except here in South Africa, where we have the big emissions. So to what extent, by actually doing things in Africa, we're affecting Africa? Or is it so interrelated that one can't really say, and it's just generally what happens in the world? Because, I mean, you know, if you've got Europe, and you've got all the emissions being emanated from there, and I can understand what it does there, to what extent does that impact in this side of the world and the rest of it? I need to have some linkages like that. I don't necessarily, I mean, I can understand it's an intricate question. You want to think about it and give an answer later, but if you can respond,
okay.
How are we to understand that?
Or how am I to understand
that? Chair, it's a very, very important question, and it's perfect before these negotiations as well, because that, to a large extent, is a lot of the work around the negotiation is who is to blame, really. That's what it boils down to. The unfortunate thing is that it's not, as you say, it's just really not a very simple situation. The global system is so connected. There is no way that you can ever sort of say that this flood is attributed to the emissions from South Africa, for example. Let me give you an example of another global phenomenon which we've actually managed to solve. And that was, people may recall, this huge panic around the ozone hole, where we'd put a whole bunch of CFCs up into the air that basically destroyed this protective layer that stops UV coming down to the planet. And if that ozone hole opened up even more and more, skin cancer would increase, it would be a disaster. But basically, we've controlled CFCs and now the ozone hole, it's still a hole, but it's starting to recover. The reality is that most of those CFCs were released in the north, but the ozone hole is in the south. And this is, I think, is a classic example of how connected these systems really are in terms of the movement of pollution. We're measuring, for instance, at Cape Point, and many of you may know this, but the South African Weather Service's Global Atmospheric Watch Station is one of the few global atmospheric watch stations around the world that has been measuring temperatures and concentrations for years. It's one of the globally recognized centers of science, right just down the road. Has been measuring this massive increase in carbon concentrations for years. They've also been looking at the stream of carbon coming from various areas as well, and the flows and things. But the reality is that the climate change is becoming because of the overall concentrations. And those over concentrations are due to our emissions and our historical emissions. And we must remember that South Africa has been a coal-based economy for many, many years, unlike the newer economies that have been using coal quite recently. We've been using it for years. Your question becomes very, very difficult when one asks, what is our carbon debt, actually? Has South Africa used up its carbon space, for example? That starts getting into the realm of the far more difficult to answer. On some levels, as a developing country, we say that we must have carbon space as a developing nation. But if one just does a pure accounting exercise and cuts the cake in certain ways and sort of said, if, for instance, we want to keep planetary temperatures below 2 degrees, then, of course, there's a maximum concentration of carbon that we can have. If we then take that maximum concentration of carbon and basically divide it amongst the people of the world, so completely equitably, and work out then what your carbon budget is per nation. Naturally, of course, the developed countries would have to reduce their carbon dramatically. But South Africa doesn't do very well in that discussion either. The rest of Africa looks fine. We look a bit grim. And in essence, I mean, when you start looking at our carbon emissions, there have been people that have said that South Africa is Africa's U.S. And so that's precise, God forbid. But the situation is that, I mean, unfortunately, as a nation who's really built its wealth, its energy wealth, on the fossil fuel industry, that's the legacy we live with, and it's a reality. But the lucky thing, Chair, just to finally answer this, is that in terms of our commitment, if, for instance, we're saying that we've gone over the budget, which many people believe we have, then it's very difficult for us to sort of say that the changes that are happening in this country are just as a result of what's happened in the north. We have to take some of the blame. Not all of it, but some of it is still with us.
Would our immediate neighbors in Southern Africa, would they show the same patterns?
In some instances, even worse. Yeah. Even worse. There are areas, for instance, where the levels of poverty are far higher, where the subsistence agriculture is far, far higher. So in other words, people are more dependent on the land than we are. And they're going to have exactly the same changes. They're going to have dramatic reductions in rainfall.
I mean, I'm talking really about this heat increases. The increases you've shown here, are those the same in those countries?
Absolutely.
I mean, I understand the consequences may be different because of the countries.
Absolutely. And in actual fact, Chair, I mean, it's because it is so uniform in terms of the sort of, well, not uniform, I mean, of course, the temperature increases change slightly, but they will suffer the same kind of consequences. And because of that, people are really, really concerned around the whole aspect of climate refugees. It's because in Zimbabwe, the temperatures are going to increase. There's a whole chance that, for instance, areas at this stage, are not malaria areas will become malaria areas. In other words, disease burdens will increase. So people will start moving. And people do. I mean, in Africa, people migrate from areas of major stress. So that's another aspect of climate change that is not very well researched. They know that there's a potential that we're going to have climate change refugees, but no one's really done that kind of research. But your question is exactly correct, is that the kind of temperature increases we are going to be felt exactly by our neighbors.
Any other questions? All right, can we then move to the next? Ms. Ndude.
You're not sure. When you listen, you become more scared by day in terms of what is going to happen to Mother Earth. And in my mind, I've got a question that says, are we living for today in terms of our planning, or are we living for tomorrow? Well, that's not the fundamental question. In terms of our planning and everything that we do, are we living for today or are we living for tomorrow? That means looking for in the future. I don't want to pose a question, Chair. Is it more a comment that I fully agree that some of the things really is not much that one can do, can't do anything, because as a result of nature. But you have got scientists, you have got people who have, you know, when starting to do this subject, when I'm saying are we living for today or for future, maybe the scientists, when they are, you know, giving some, input to us in the next day or two, really one would want to hear that planning of either for today or for tomorrow, so that we can really be able to understand where we are. As a nation, in terms of the planning for the people of today, of the future of our grandchildren, or for that matter, maybe not our children, now, and also the real future, so that maybe as people that are going to hosting the COP17 will really begin to grapple with the reality that we live in a forest.
Thank you, and it's immediately easier, so at least one scientist can hear that we're going to ask those questions tomorrow. But it would be worthwhile to start pulling some of those threads together. Mr. Matebe?
Thank you, Chair. My question is almost similar to yours. As South Africa is a highly industrialized country, more than our neighbors, for instance, Botswana. Now, don't, think due to our this high emission of this greenhouse gases, don't we affect the environment of those areas? And if yes, do you have any collaboration with the officials from those countries as to how can we join to combat this?
Anyone want to respond?
Sure, I can.
Silent,
so no. Well, the thing is, I mean, once again, I think this comes straight down to the fact that this is the basis of the international negotiation. The reality is that if, for instance, we were to go to our neighbors and sort of say, well, we produce a huge amount of greenhouse gases, and we could be responsible for a whole bunch of deaths of your citizens. It's not great for international relations, and that certainly won't be a sort of situation where they're going to sort of say, thank you very much. So we have to be exceptionally diplomatic in this sort of situation as well, but we also, I think most importantly, and I think we've acknowledged this as a South African nation, is that we actually have to do something about it. We have to actually reduce. And in actual fact, if one considers it, South Africa has made far more as a developing country of at least a political commitment to replaying its role as a responsible global citizen than many developed countries. So we've actually gone an extra mile, and I think it's typical of the South African people and our nation that we say that we are global citizens and we need to do something about it. And so in that sort of sense, we've been giving that signal very, very strongly. And in many instances, people shake their heads and sort of say South Africa is too strong on this. But the reality is, I think throughout the whole process, is that we believe in justice, and with that, we believe in global justice. So that's the situation. In terms of our neighbors know exactly what our greenhouse gas profile looks like. The second national communication contains our every single aspect around exactly what our emissions profile looks like, and it's published on the United Nations website. So everybody, we can't hide. We can't hide our emissions. Everybody knows it. So Botswana and Swaziland and Mozambique know exactly that in terms of the contributions to greenhouse gases, that although Africa only is responsible for 2%, we're responsible for 50% of that 2%. So we're responsible for half of Africa's emissions come from this country alone. And so within that, we can't hide behind those facts.
Dr. Sylvester will add on the structures that we use in SADC on specifically the adaptation side of consultation and working together.
Okay, just maybe to add, the point is that climate change has got no boundaries, and as a result of that, I mean, we are being forced to collaborate with other countries, I mean, in the region, and as a result of that, there are various platforms through SADC Secretariat that South Africa is also part of that group. Recently, we have just finalized the Southern African Climate Change Framework, and South Africa has been actively involved in that process. Besides that, the fact that, I mean, South Africa shares hydrological system with our neighboring countries like Lesotho, Swaziland, Mozambique, and so on. So, for example, if there's a drought in Zimbabwe or in Botswana, somehow it's going to affect us, especially the Limpopo province. So as a result of that, there is this, I mean, sub-regional, I mean, collaborations wherein some of our scientists are running multidisciplinary, I mean, project with other scientists, I mean, at sub-regional level. So there are various interventions, like, for example, within the water sector, there is rainwater harvesting, I mean, project, wherein South Africa, Mozambique, Botswana, I mean, is also involved. If you look at within the agriculture sector, this, I mean, the food security program that is being run by SADC Secretariat, and almost 9 countries are involved. So the good thing is that, I mean, it's not only about collaborating, but also exchanging and sharing information and making sure that we develop various, I mean, adaptation strategies, I mean, within the SADC region.
Yes. As we have rightly so said, that we are responsible for more than half of these other countries' emissions. Do those countries in terms of these natural disasters that might be caused by climate change, can they legally claim compensation from us?
No. No. They won't be able to. There's not an international court, Mr. Matebe. There's not an international court that can sit and listen to cases and say, well, you've omitted this much, you put it in the air. So I think that's the first thing, is that there's no structure to do it. But the second issue is you wouldn't be able to create the linkage. I mean, just like our temperature here has risen by X amount. I mean, clearly all of that is not because of what we do here. I mean, it's what people do. But how would we be able to show that this comes from America or from Brazil?
Or
from
experts can formulate something.
Now look, lawyers can do anything. I mean, you know, but that doesn't mean it's right. That doesn't mean they're going to mean it. And because they're not going to really make money and only pay money in the case, I think the chances that they... But you know, there may be a mad one somewhere. Which is just about 90% of them. So, you know, you never know.
If I may try to answer his question, the point is that it's going to be very difficult for those countries, I mean, to claim damages against South Africa. Firstly, they don't have good infrastructure, like, for example, the automatic weather station and so on. And they rely on South Africa. If you look, I mean, Mozambique, I mean, as an example, South African weather service has got, I mean, more than 50 automatic weather stations in those countries for flood warnings and all those kind of things. So if there is a potential for floods that break, source to send out information to Mozambique to say there are chances that, I mean, there might be floods or outbreaks. So there is that, I mean, memorandum of agreement, and I don't think they will try to spoil that relationship, but you cannot rule out, right?
The more likely thing to happen is what Mr. Luke has said, and that is that you get climate change refugees. That's more likely. That if you things start collapsing in other countries because of, you know, severe drought, then your chances of people flooding in here is even bigger than it is now. And I think that's going to be our punishment, being the country in the south of Africa, is that probably most of those people would flood here. Mr. Traylor and then Mr. Morgan.
On that point, I mean, there was the case of Tuvalu, I think, who was looking at bringing, I think it was a law case against the United States, I think it was, for compensation for the fact that they were going to lose their nation. So there was that. I'm not sure what happened with it in the end, but there has been an international kind of precedent where they've looked at this.
I think the first problem that starts with this would be the jurisdiction of it. Because, you know, if you want to have a case between two countries, which court will hear it? It can't be American court hearing something happening in Uganda or vice versa. So I think that's the first issue. There's no forum where it can take place. If there's some linkage in that country's law that creates some obligation on that country, then maybe that would be your basis to bring liability. But I'm not aware of countries. Mr. Morgan?
The chairperson, thanks. I think what we would more likely see, and this talking from a Southern African perspective, is that the contestation and possible subsequent legal challenges would be more on the impacts of climate change. So, for example, contestation over transboundary water resources and whether the allocations, for example, live up to what the protocols say. So, when last week we had the briefing by the Kumasi Basin Authority, of which there's a certain allocation that Mozambique is supposed to get, and we have to honour that. And under one of the predictions here being scarcer resources, although, you know, some might argue there might be more water there, but my general point is that it will be the impacts which will be contested. And so it could be a case that our neighbours and ourselves in the future might find ourselves in those kinds of conflicts. And one of the, I suspect, hotspots of Southern Africa in the future will probably be potential conflict between Namibia and Botswana, who are per capita even more water scarce than we are, and share a really highly contested area around Caprivi and the island, which all question around fresh water. And those are issues which, as a country, and certainly from our geopolitical implications, which as the regional player in Southern Africa are going to have to take note of under future climate change.
Now that makes sense, because there are legal agreements. If the water comes from South Africa, suddenly it starts drying up, then people say, well, you must now still honor your agreement. Well, then clearly that's a really strong basis.
Chair, I just want to alert the committee in terms of the comments that was made by Honorable Mdude in terms of planning and this, how do we plan for the future. I think there's two processes currently underway that the committee should maybe ask for briefings on, and the one is the Spatial Planning and Land Use Management Bill, which we as the department and both and the Department of Water Affairs have argued very strongly that the resource base and the climate change and the strategy for sustainable development and also issues about competing land uses and vulnerability need to be elevated in that act, because that is going to inform the spatial form going forward. And the other process is run by the Planning Commission, which is the finalization of the spatial vision for the country. And I think that those are both important policy developments that which should actually give effect to the science and the findings and embed this in something that will make our future sustainable.
Yeah, you see, that's the kind of debate we had the other day with the Deputy Minister about what we mean by a green economy. Is it some sector that's somewhere, or does actually your whole economic planning depend on you locating whatever you're doing, whether it's spatial planning, whether it's building of roads, building of houses, within a but within the ecology, so that the economy becomes part of the ecology and how it works, and not the other way around. And it seems to me we're going to have to go somewhere with that debate.
Yeah.
And that may be something that we should be raising in our report, that there are different conceptualizations of the green economy. And clearly what is meant by it is, I think Mr. Kralen captured it the best for me, is that your economy is actually part of the ecology, and the ecology is not part of the economy. It's not that way around. So you fit the economy into the ecology. It's the other way around. The economy has to fit in. Now, if you do that, and if your department starts thinking like that, well, then it solves the problem, because then a bill on spatial planning should immediately take into consideration the ecological impact of that bill. If you come with housing issues, the same. You know, building of dams, the same. So all of it should be, and maybe that is one of the things we can, if someone will take a note, that we should be dealing with a bit more in our report, that we feel that some attention should be given to this in government, at how we see the economy actually fitting in there in a balanced and sustainable way than looking at it the other way around. So I think that's one of the points we can already capture quite nicely. And your example of this act is a good example, that where we need to make sure that that takes place. Of course, that puts an extra strong responsibility on your department, because in every piece of legislation that now goes to cabinet, it is your responsibility to raise those points in cabinet and to make sure that right in the beginning, it's no use bringing it to parliament and then trying to claw back the situation. It should become part of the thinking up front. You know, even with the drafting of the bill, but I think that's asking a bit too much, because I think each department will not have that skill. But it puts a huge responsibility on the department. So you must know now, every bill that slips through, that hasn't got that in there, I personally will blame you for having missed it. As the COO, will personally get, and the acting DG of climate change, because they missed that in the bill. I'm joking about it, but actually it's quite serious. I in another life of mine, I've been there, and although cabinet committees work as committees, as a cluster, that does not necessarily mean that people automatically think in terms of integration. In fact, often it's quite the opposite. Even here in Parliament, we try and work as clusters. People still think that a cluster is you come and tell other people what you're doing, they tell you what they're doing, and then you work now together because you've told them what you do. Whereas it's rather an issue of how do you integrate programs and processes, and that is important, I think, for you guys to then trace in the legislation. Okay, that's a point well worth making. All right, is that it? Can we move to the next one? Next input, who is that? Ms. McCourt?
It's still Mr. Lukey.
Still Mr. Lukey, yeah, he's still.
I'm still
a real talker.
I'm still the base.
Which paper are you going to talk to about now?
I'm going to go on to the green paper itself.
The big one?
Yes. I think this discussion is a really good precursor to this presentation for the simple reason it starts giving us an indication that why we need a national policy is that in terms of climate change, if it cuts across the portfolios of all the sectoral departments and you need to have some level of coordination and cooperation and alignment between activities, then of course that's a perfect reason for a national policy. And that, I think, was recognized some time ago. The policy as it stands, and the document that you have, you've got the glossy version in your packs, which is supposed to make it look a little more attractive. But in essence, it's a 36-page document. It has evolved from a document over 200 pages long. That we all knew that, first of all, we weren't expecting parliamentarians to read, when even our senior managers just didn't have the time to read it, that a government policy of such detail. Now, a thing of such detail is, first of all, it's never going to be passed for the simple reason that there'll be such discussion around certain intimate details of various things. Absolutely. So what we had to do was we've gone through a very long process to try and slice it down to its core and its fundamentals. And as such, I think the best way of describing it is probably framework policy to provide the overall responses that we as a nation should take without going into the very, very minor details of how we should do it. Also, within the situation is that there are issues where we don't actually have policy solutions. So what we've had to do in the policy document itself is basically look at policy around how we get to a solution. So in other words, where we don't have a solution, we hopefully have flagged issues and said this is how we'll get to it. But in essence, if I can go through this, the policy development process has quite a long history. It started in 2004, the National Climate Change Strategy, which was something that South Africa did as, and let's be honest, kind of as a response to our commitments in terms of the international, we'd become a party to the international agreements, the United Nations Framework Convention. And we felt that we needed to show that this nation was going to respond to our commitments in terms of climate change. If one reads that document now, it looks somewhat naive and very empty, actually. It's full of promises and we'd like to's and what have you. But it was a good start. It got the nation signed to think about the issue. By 2005, we had the Climate Change Conference, which was internationally recognized as a conference that was groundbreaking in one very, very important respect. Is that it was actually two conferences in one. The first one was a science conference, which basically brought together all the South African scientists and African and regional scientists to a conference that started on the Monday, and then a policy conference that started on the Tuesday. And the policy conference, every morning, it started with a feedback from the scientists saying, we have discussed sea level rise. And then that became the focus of the discussions in the policy context. And it was seen as quite revolutionary in the sense that many policy conferences, and at that time as well, you must remember that there were a lot of articles sort of claiming that climate change, there was a lot of denialism around the whole situation as well. It was very, very easy then for people to stand up at a policy conference and say, well, we don't know if that's actually the fact. It was easy for us then to walk next door and to say, scientists, is this the fact? And they would come through and they would confirm what they knew in science. So one of the most important outcomes of that was that, first of all, there was a South African government commitment to climate change as being something that was happening. It was basically, we thought that the amount of resources that would was spent on dealing with the denialists all the time is just really a waste of money and waste of resources. And therefore, there was a clear statement that said that South Africa sees climate change as a major threat, and it's happening. The other aspect was that a thing came out called the Midrand Plan of Action. And in the Midrand Plan of Action, there was a decision made that we would create a national climate change policy. But there was also a decision made, which is also very, very important, is that at that stage, we as a nation, and it comes back to the early discussion around our carbon profile, we sort of said, well, you know, we're a developing country, we're a coal-based country, there's nothing we can do about the mitigation elements. We have a high greenhouse gas profile, but there's nothing we can do. So one of the things that the conference said was that we need to find out what we can do. And that was a decision to do what then became known as the long-term mitigation scenarios, which is a modeling exercise to see what we can do from a mitigation point of view, how we can reduce our carbon. So by October 2007, we had the draft long-term mitigation scenarios that actually showed that it was possible for South Africa to reduce our carbon footprint quite dramatically. In July 2008, Cabinet gave policy directions based on that and other information that basically said South Africa as a nation, in terms of our international obligations, in terms of us as a global citizen, we will peak, plateau, and decline our emissions. So we basically sort of said that we would, as a developing nation, we would still increase our carbon emissions up to 2020 to 2025, and then we'd plateau them for 10 years, and then after 10 years we'd start reducing them. And we thought that was a very, very fair contribution to global emission reductions. Cabinet also then sort of said we need to have a climate change policy. In March 2009, we had the Climate Change Summit, which was opened by the President, had 7 cabinet ministers as speakers. It was live streamed across the world, and unfortunately with South Africa's terrible broadband, most South Africans couldn't see it, but everybody else in the world could follow our climate change conference very, very nicely. We had international blogging.
Some of our dams. Everyone 100 kilometers away can get water, but people living next to us can't get water.
I'm afraid it's also the same with our electricity, if you look at our if you look at our power stations. But within that sort of situation, we had live stream blogging, so it was a very, very interesting event, and high profile as well. And that was basically the public launch of this policy process. And interestingly enough, it discussed a kind of a policy framework, and the climate change conference came up with a huge long list of areas of complete consensus with South Africans where there was no debate, where there was no real argument about what we needed to do. And the things like, for instance, we needed to reduce our emissions. Everybody agreed. Even the biggest industrialists whose industries were based in fossil fuels believed that there was a need for us to actually reduce this. There were things like, for instance, we needed to adapt. We had to start building up our resilience. We had to start looking at emergency incidents and what have you. So we had this long list of areas of consensus. In actual fact, the conference only identified at that stage 3 areas where there was no consensus whatsoever. And those 3 areas were as follows. The first one was the South African energy mix. And what the South African electricity mix should look like, there was no agreement. And with that, and let's be honest about it, that debate is really around where does nuclear fit into the South African energy mix. So the anti-nuclear lobby basically sort of said, we don't want to see nuclear in that mix. From a climate change perspective, nuclear always goes into the mix. It is a low carbon source of energy. The next area of debate was the whole sort of situation of energy planning. There was a strong sort of call saying that in terms of the way we plan energy in this country, it's not transparent, the decisions are made, and no one really gets a chance to do that. And of course, things have changed quite dramatically since 2009 in terms of the IRP and the new energy planning process. So a lot of this stuff has already been addressed, but that was an area where there was no consensus. The third area of lack of consensus was that it was based on a point of consensus that said one of the things we need to do to mitigate carbon was to put a price on carbon. That was agreed. Everybody sort of said that what we are doing now is we're reaping the bitter harvest of spewing carbon out into the atmosphere without paying the costs. Now the future generations are paying the costs. And so the whole aspect of actually pricing carbon as a mechanism to reduce carbon was agreed. How to price carbon was not agreed. Naturally, National Treasury is very, very keen on a tax, as they always are, and quite rightly so in this particular instance. Industry, of course, would rather see the completely opposite thing, saying don't tax us, rather give us incentives to do the right things. But in all these sort of situations, it's around putting a price on carbon. But there was no consensus on how we do that. There is also a very strong South African lobby who is basically against any trade in carbon on two issues. First of all, from political points of view, their political point of view being that, for instance, that there can be no solution to climate change under capitalism. And the second one is that, for instance, it is immoral to take a pollutant and make it a tradable commodity. So there are people in the country, and these are very strong lobbies, but small, but very vocal, who have strong moral arguments against certain ways of doing these things. Then the policy process, after that very, very quick and exciting start and that area of consensus on which to build, the policy process slowed down a bit because of the Copenhagen negotiations, and everybody had exceptionally high hopes that Copenhagen would come up with a global solution. So basically the policy process held its breath to see what commitments would come out of that conference that we could then put into a policy. As it turned out, from a framework convention point of view, Copenhagen was a bit of a damn squib. But what we did have was the Copenhagen Accord, and with that, the South African commitments in terms of that, in terms of where we want to go, and that came from the President. In May 2010, we did a policy roundtable just to bring all the key stakeholders together to say where we were, and by November, we published the Green Paper, which is the one we're discussing. We have conducted a series of provincial workshops in all provinces around the country, and those finished last week. And the level of participation has been excellent. They started off in Cape Town. We had around 90 people in the first provincial workshop. It ended in Gauteng with 200 people. But every single province has had its workshop. The kind of issues that have been brought up have been interesting. They've also confirmed what we already suspected around some of the major issues. We've also realized, of course, that they're not, and you'll find this within the parliamentary hearings as well, is that they're often not the place where people will actually do their lobby work. So, for instance, industry, as an example, are often very well represented in the audience of the provincial workshops, but they keep their powder dry. They are there mostly as observers to see what civil society is saying, and then they'll use things like NEDLAC and what have you as their way of actually caucusing and lobbying and so on and so forth. But even with that said, there are a number of companies that don't fall within the big umbrella groups, so we actually hear their points of view as well, but normally the smaller ones. So it's been a very, very worthwhile exercise, and if there's time, Chen, with your permission, I can give you an indication of the emerging issues from there as well, which are quite interesting. And I have a presentation on that.
Do we know, if they come up here, that we know these already are the ones that are being canned?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm going to switch this, but this was the implementation plan approved by Cabinet in 2008. We've fallen behind for various reasons, but we're still on track. The policy development process, as I said, the provincial workshops have now been completed. The formal public comment process or period has come to an end on the 15th of February. And we've received a huge amount of comments. For example, from Business Unity South Africa, we received 76 pages of comments, which is double the size of the actual policy itself. We've received over 400 individual submissions, some of them very, very small and minor, some of them quite substantial. What is happening now is we're actually having very focused discussions around certain elements. So, for instance, on Monday we had a focused workshop on financing and looking at the whole aspect of how do we finance our climate change response. There'll be aspects on adaptation and others as well. Then, of course, there is your own process, which is the public hearings process, but there's also other parallel processes too. And those are the integrated resource planning process, which is basically mapping out South Africa's energy future, electricity future. There's the integrated energy planning, which is looking at our energy future. There is Treasury's work around the use of economic instruments, and specifically their discussion document release around carbon taxes. Now, all of these, of course, are processes that we will keep a very, very close eye on, and of course, take all the information from there and use it as input into the finalization of the paper. Comments and analysis have started already, and will carry on until April. It's said there, for instance, that we're going to have this final national conference on the 4th of March. That is not going to happen. And I was hoping, sure, that we could actually have a discussion to see if we could look at the organization of a final national conference as the culmination of your public hearing process, in fact, if that would be something that you'd be interested in looking at, because we need to relook at this final process. And I think there's an elegance, I think, in bringing the two together. Then the final draft white paper must be submitted to Cabinet by May, June. And the reason why we want to have this finished by mid-year is because, as you all know, we are hosting COP17. And if we start mixing local policy with the very complex international negotiating stance, where, of course, South Africa will say certain things in international sections to leverage certain things in the national interest, which doesn't mean that, for instance, we morally don't think that we should be doing the opposite. So rather than complicating the issues of local policy, what we as South Africans say is our contribution to what we will actually say in international negotiations in the national interest, we need to actually have the one close to make sure we don't have this confusion. And that's the intention.
Broadly, I agree with what you're saying. But we must also be careful. That mustn't mean that we must rush things. You know, if we, 2 weeks later, 1 month later, let us target to get it done. But you know, for example, the president has now appointed the minister who's responsible for the international thrust and the minister responsible. So immediately the chances of confusing the two becomes less.
Absolutely.
Because clearly the minister, our minister, is now going to take up the South African policy positions, and clearly the other minister is dealing with international. So broadly I agree, let us finalize these processes. Because at some stage one has to make decisions and say, this is what we're going to do. That's my reasoning, Brian. You can't drag this on forever. You know, there is going to be some level of disagreement always in things. And somewhere you bite the bullet. So that is fine. But if we take 2 weeks longer, 1 week longer, let us not rush the process and let people feel that there's been a kind of a bulldozing. Let us, I mean, do what you're doing now. I think what the processes you've going through over the years now has been a great one. And let's bring it to conclusion somewhere in the middle of the year. But let us not put deadlines on ourselves that may become self-defeating. Okay? That's all I wanted to say about it.
Thank you, Chair. And I think you're absolutely correct. Unfortunately, my boss is sitting down there, and she's a deadline person.
That was good.
Absolutely.
But you know, I've seen in government, there's been excellent processes that have gone through. And there's been some bit of disagreement by a few. And in the end, you suddenly rush something, and what becomes the issue is the rushing, and not the fact that a few people disagree with what you're doing.
Yes.
So that's all I'm trying to say. The process, and we learned this in negotiation, the process is as important as the substance at the end.
Absolutely.
We agree.
Absolutely.
It's very vital that people feel that there's been a process. Not in the end when you disagree, it's because you quickly chopped it down.
Yeah.
And now these people that we disagree with are just, you know, and that's all I'm saying.
No, absolutely. Okay? Joe, I think in that, I mean, you're absolutely 100% correct. But the simple reason is that this policy is a policy for everybody. And if we don't actually get buy-in to it, it's just more hot air, unfortunately. In terms of the Green Paper structure, the way that, I think it's important, first of all, to talk about the department's role in this. This is government's policy. And the department's mandate from Cabinet was that we have to facilitate the development of this policy, which meant that we actually have to physically pull the inputs from the various line sectors that are actually doing the work. And that's where this is all about. I mean, what we've tried to do is we've tried to take the inputs and of varying quality and detail from all the sector departments that are quite clearly impacted by climate change, and then try and weld them into a policy that is coherent, cohesive, and hangs together in some way. And we're hoping that through this policy document, through the 36 pages, we've managed to do that. So when you read through the policy, there's a feeling that, for instance, this is government policy, and it's not just a cobbling together of various things from agriculture and water and what have you. And so through that, the structure of the paper is quite important as well, to give it that kind of coherence and that feel. So the first section is a very brief introduction, basically saying this is the issue, this is the problem, and this is what we need to do. Very short and sweet. Section 2 basically sums up the entire objective of the policy. And the objective has two parts. The one is the mitigation objective. It basically sort of says that we will make a fair contribution. It doesn't say what that is. And one of the things that has come out in the public hearings is sort of saying, well, who says it's fair? Well, that's what this policy must do. The policy must sort of say that we as South Africans think that this is a fair contribution. Then the second part of it is that we will adapt. No matter how successful the international negotiations are, even if we have the miracle of COP17 in South Africa sort of saying we're going to cut down greenhouse gases dramatically, even if we have that, this kind of outcome that I think many people, specifically people like Tuvalu, the islands that are being lost as people live in them, are praying for. If we get that, we will still have the impact of climate change for many, many years. So we're going to have to, the second part is we have to still adapt. And so that's the second part of our objective, is that we then build up our resilience as a nation to climate change. Then we have a section on principles. And basically this is the kind of our checklist to make sure that we are honest, is that in the kind of interventions and responses that we look at, we have this whole thing of going back to the principles that govern the nation. And in those, we've teased out a number that have been brought to our attention that are specifically relevant to the climate change issue. And the example used here is the precautionary principle, simply because these things happen over so many years. And to come back to the Honourable Dooley's comment about future generations, the whole aspect about planning for future generations is not just a requirement, it's a constitutional requirement. Section 24 says we have to protect the environment for this and future generations. So we actually have to think about it. It's not a case of whether we want to or not. We have to constitutionally do this. So within that, the whole aspect of the precautionary principle, if we don't know what the impacts are, we have to decide on this. We have to take a risk-averse approach. Then section 4 is the strategy. And this is a list of key strategies to be employed. So in other words, if we've mapped out where we are, we've mapped out where we want to be, these are the strategies that we'll employ from getting from A to B. And those things like the example here is we will use economic instruments. And what that means, for example, is that if we put a price on carbon, then the market will make necessary changes. So those are one of the strategies that we'll use. We will use economic instruments. Section 5 is the meat of, and it's the real detail of the policy. And I'll unpack exactly what that's all about now. Section 6 talks about roles and responsibilities. In the initial early drafts, there were long lists of the department will do this, the Department of Health will do this, and what have you. And it was just a realization right from the start that because of the cross-cutting nature of this, to actually put things in silos was certainly not going to have alignment. So in essence, you'll see throughout the process there's a whole sort of situation where it argues the point that climate change changes the landscape in which we do work. It doesn't change the work that we do. So if you're a department that builds houses, under a climate change response regime, you will continue to build houses. You'll just do it differently. You'll start looking at thermal efficiency, how you actually increase the thermal efficiency of homes in a cost-effective way. If you're an energy planning department, you will continuously do energy planning, except you will start looking at things like low carbon pathways and so on and so forth. So that's what it argues. It basically says that this cross cuts across the work of government. Section 7 deals with the institutional framework for coordination, and basically what this is saying also is that we don't want to try and create a whole bunch of new structures. We must try and utilize the structures that are already in place more effectively, and that's the way we will do it. Section 8 deals with the all-important aspect of inputs and resource mobilization. If, for instance, this was cheap and easy, we wouldn't be having this policy because we'd be doing it normally. We have to do things, and this may cost. And so therefore, there's discussion around how we mobilize financial resources, what we need to do to mobilize the human resources and the technological resources, and then we're looking at very strongly at information. Because as you see, because of the long-term nature of this, we have to start building up some level of certainty before we start spending money. So the whole aspect of information is a large chunk of this particular policy. Then finally, Section 9, in terms of government policy, it talks about monitoring, evaluation, and review. And it's basically the first, it's divided up in two parts. First of all, we need to monitor climate change. We know, we need to know exactly how much our sea level is rising. It's, we can't take guesses at this. In South Africa, we've been exceptionally lucky. Many people don't know this, but for instance, South African Weather Service has one of the longest uninterrupted rainfall data sets in the world. Now, very few people realize that, but of course, from a climate change perspective, that is gold as far as data is concerned. And having the Global Atmospheric Watch station at Cape Point has also provided us with fantastic information around global concentrations of carbon and what have you. So our science base is good. In terms, and you'll hear this from Dr. Midgley, in terms of how we, how our scientists play in their role in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, highly respected authors and lead authors of many sections of the papers. So the South African science team in the international science community, highly respected scientists. But then the final bit of monitoring, of course, is the whole aspect of that. If we're saying that we're going to reduce our emissions, we need a way of measuring how much we actually are doing. And that, of course, is the fundamental measure from the mitigation point of view. Is if this is our carbon, we need an inventory of our emissions, and then we need to measure that to see how our reductions are happening. So then the section 5, which is the meat of the document, initially it started off with this long list of sectors. And in the initial discussion, somebody sort of said, well, it's nice and very diplomatic of the department to have given equal weight to every single sector, but it's not helpful. So from that, there was a long discussion about how we started doing some element of prioritization. And so therefore, there are key adaptation sectors, and these really are ones that are being lifted up as the most important. The first one is water. And of course, as a water-poor country, as one of our most limiting resources, water has to be the area where we really, really turn our attention. The next aspect, of course, is agriculture. We're still quite an agrarian society. We know in terms of government's priorities, in terms of job creation, there is huge potential for job creation in the agricultural sector. But there's also a massive potential for massive destruction within the agricultural sector as a result of climate change. Then the next element is human health, an area that has huge impacts. We've seen globally things like, for instance, heat waves wiping out young and old people. The whole aspect in South Africa and Southern Africa of increase in malaria and so on and so forth. I mean, these are all really, really important aspects, and health has to be looking at this. Then from the mitigation sectors, the first one that is on the list is the obvious one, energy. We get most of our electricity from coal. We drive around in petrol vehicles. As South Africans, we seem to be quite nice outdoorsy people, so either we drive charabans or we drive 4x4s. So our profile in terms of emissions is dramatic, and it's based on fossil fuels. Industry have, for many, many years, had a situation where they've been paying the cheapest electricity prices in the world. As a result of that, if one asks, you know, what do they invest in, they obviously invest in energy-intensive technologies, because if your input costs are so cheap, that's where you go. So instead of employing lots of people, you employ lots of machines. And if your energy is so cheap, you don't have to really maintain the machines very well. So in other words, some industries, for instance, have electric pumps that have been in place for 50 years. They've been rewired 50 times, which means that they are about as efficient as they would be if, for instance, they were not working at all. Which means that the profile of energy efficiency in the South African industrial sector is dire. The reality, of course, that means is that our industries are not very competitive, really, especially as the price of electricity starts increasing. Transport. The most efficient form of public transport in South Africa is the informal public transport, the taxis. In terms of mass transport for public transport, in terms of government, it's not been a great success story at all. And the reality is that as South Africans, we see our own private vehicles as status symbols. As soon as you earn a certain salary, then you move into a higher range of vehicle. And it's normally, rather than getting more streamlined vehicles, you start getting vehicles that look more and more like bricks as you get wealthier. And those bricks have to have huge engines to actually push you forward. So the area of transport is also an area that is a real chance for some massive reductions. The next area, of course, is disaster management. Disaster management is the thing that is happening now. And luckily, through the work that we did around the dam squib that was Y2K, we built up the National Disaster Management Center, have really, really good national disaster legislation in place, and to a large extent, we are doing exceptionally well around early warning systems and what have you, far better than many developed countries, in fact. The natural resource sector, terrestrial biodiversity. Terrestrial biodiversity, apart from being good for the soul, is also good for our pockets. And we're one of the top mega diverse countries in the world. And it's something that's really, really, that we should be proud of. And in actual fact, it's a fantastic thing. It's also one of our biggest growth sectors, is the tourism industry around that, largely around our culture and our natural heritage. Our marine biodiversity has been under threat for many, many years. Before climate change, our fishing stocks, we've had collapses of fish, have always been a problem. Commercial forestry, a big sector, potentially hard hit by climate change. Fisheries, massive problem. We've already had situations where we believe through climatic conditions fish have moved from the one coast to the other, which means that they're caught on the one coast, they have to be transferred from the east coast to the west coast to the factories. By the time they get to the factories, the fish is rotten. It goes into a fish meal plant and we start processing rotten fish, and the smell from that is just making people's lives completely miserable. A climate change result that ends up with smell on the west coast. Then we have human society livelihoods and services. And the document starts looking at a thing around human infrastructure. And of course, this is really, really important. I mean, low-level bridges suddenly start becoming inadequate if we start having increases in floods. Our built environments. The whole aspect around planning, and I think the COO's comment about one of the most important responses we can make to climate change, is to almost re-educate our town planners around how we have to do proper town planning. And then the last sector we looked at here in terms of these human society livelihoods and services is waste. Waste is an interesting one. Waste in South Africa is responsible for 2% of our emissions, which seems small, but it's also quite an easy win. And it's basically because we put a whole bunch of wet waste into our landfills. It forms methane, and we just let the methane run. The methane, of course, is a fantastic fuel, and places like the city of Etiquini is converting their methane completely into electricity. So they have generators on top of their landfill sites that generate electricity for the city. So that changes the methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas, into CO2, which is less powerful. And therefore, they mitigate climate change but provide a cheap source of electricity from their waste. For each one of those sectors, Chair, there is a brief, basic paragraph sort of saying, what does climate change mean for that sector? And just in a nutshell, sort of crystallizes the key aspects of it. Then the next thing sort of pulls out some very clear, concise bullet points of climate change impacts on that sector or how that sector impacts on climate change. Brief, succinct, factual bullet points. And then finally it sort of says, in order to address the above challenges, South Africa will, and there are numbered bullet points of what interventions we will actually take. So, in itself, for each one of those sectors, we've sort of said they look the same, you can compare them and what have you, and hopefully that makes it also very, very readable in terms of problem, major issues, and how we're going to address it. And that's the way it's structured. Chair, the rest of the presentation goes through each one of these sectors in detail, and I leave it to you whether you want me to go through each one in detail.
Let's just stop here and see the question, but I didn't want you to go through the sectors, so we have a feel for it. Any issues you want to raise on the general stuff, the detail will come now. Mr. Matebe?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, mine is on consultation. I appreciate the fact that you tried to cover almost every area in the country by holding those provincial workshops. But to me, that's not enough, because I imagine you were only relying on provincial and local structures to invite those stakeholders. And and sometimes these local structures might only invite those stakeholders that would be easier for them to attend, leaving out those poor, vulnerable people in the deep rural areas. But now I want to know as to whether have you put any mechanism in place to make sure that those poor people are also taken on board. And again, last year we met one unit manager from the Department of Water Affairs, who's the unit head of climate change in Water Affairs. She was bitterly complaining that her unit is not being taken on board by the environmental department. So, run your processes alone, and sometimes at the end you find that there is a duplication of issues because they are doing this and you are doing that. So I want to know as to how do you relate as of now with the unit in Water Affairs. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Chair. What I'd like to know is, it's a very good document, and in fact, some of the propositions in here are very detailed, and obviously step outside of the realm of the Department of Environmental Affairs and cut into other departments. So I'd like to know, once this document has finally been accepted and turned into a white paper, what kind of standing will it have in terms of ensuring that these types of actions are taken by other government departments? I mean, this is the continual kind of battle. You know, environmental affairs pushes a very progressive agenda, but often the kind of measures that are put forward are not adopted by other government departments. I mean, is this something that you feel will be taken on board by all government departments, and these very specific initiatives that are mentioned in here will in fact be adopted? And then just secondly, what kind of standing will this document have in terms of our international negotiations? Is the intention of going to COP17 in Durban to say, this has been adopted by the country, this has been adopted by government departments, and so therefore this can be, in a sense, be seen as our overall commitment in terms of reducing our emissions? Is this something that we could use as a negotiating tool in the status quo? Yeah.
Mr. Morgan?
Just in follow-up to my colleague, Mr. Grayling, I realize as you've got certain timelines and that a white paper would also be in the offing. Is it reasonable to assume then that there's a possibility that at some point there will be overarching climate legislation in which we will actually embody the commitments? Now, granted, a lot has to happen in the UNFCCC process, and there are problems there. But of course, we also have our own commitments, and we may very well want to even proceed anyway, irrespective of not achieving a binding agreement, if indeed that happens. And I'm asking for a possibility. I mean, I know you can't commit, but I mean, would it be reasonable that this process could lead to something like the United Kingdom's bill, where they actually in the statute, place their emission reductions?
Just a few things. These are three major differences which were identified in 2009. Except for the energy planning one, you say there's been some changes and some of the differences have probably disappeared. Are those other two still the two major differences that you feel exist, particularly now that you've gone through some of your hearings and so on? The second issue is, you know, I'm always strong on databases. I'm a firm believer that government should make policy on the basis of scientific evidence. And the vast part of government doesn't, because there's information available everywhere, but most policy is driven, and even here in the Parliament, is driven on the basis of assumptions. Now, it seems you're telling me that there's a whole lot of resources in this area that have databases information available. Is there or are there any plans for your unit, climate change, to actually create a national database so that in, and it particularly links to your number 9, monitoring. I mean, you can't monitor if you don't have the database, if you don't have collecting the information. So is there or is there plans to create such a national database where all this information is pulled together? And if not, why not? Because, you know, I would be pushing very strongly that that is something that should be done and a particular budget should be gotten to it. Then, you know, to follow up on Mr. Matebe's question, you know, to read these things is difficult. I mean, as you said, it's been cut down from 200 pages. You really have to be, first you have to be literate, secondly you have to have some level of cognizance of the issues and so on. So the vast majority of our people who are affected by climate change are never going to participate in this process.
Yeah. It's true.
Never.
It's true.
Even if you go and do what Mr. Matebe says and go wider to the communities and try and draw people in, the vast majority of people will not be able to do so. Now, the issue we raised with the department is you need to find other mechanisms to actually engage ordinary people. And the most effective one I have found is to create a kind of traveling circus where you put these things into pictures, into very simple graphics and stuff, little games for kids and so on. And you actually then as a department take that, particularly I think in this year of COP17, and go to ordinary communities, to municipalities. Now, we've made that suggestion already. I don't know how far we are. If we haven't moved on it, you must take us seriously about this issue. Because else we're going to ask you the question every time that Mr. Matebe is asking you, is how do we get ordinary people involved in this process? And if you're going to tell us, well, at the next meeting we're going to go to the community and tell them we're going to have a meeting there, then I'm going to laugh at you because I know the vast majority of people are not going to go to that meeting. So I need to, you know, I think it will be important, even as part of this green paper process, to actually find alternative ways of engaging communities that are affected by this. You know, there's no way better. For example, you say to me, people, and I know that, build their houses within the waterline. We know that. You go to any informal settlement, you'll find that people have built a house where there's a flood. Every year in Cape Town here, when it rains, people's houses are flooded because they're always below that line. Now, the point is, the only way we're ever going to change people is to actually start engaging them about, and the municipalities involved, because they ultimately are allowing that to happen. So, you know, I really want us to think more about this issue that Mr. Matebe has raised and be more creative about this, particularly the communication section of the department. Need to find ways of communicating this issue. And that just then put me to the last question. You see, when you say to me disaster management is excellent in this country, we've got a good, I've got no reason to gainsay that. But I want to say this to you. They are terrible communicators. You see, if you look at New Orleans, when New Orleans was busy washing away, if you look at 9/11, then there is a top person, Giuliani, who wanted to create a future for himself in politics, but okay, he did the job, who actually are communicating throughout the disaster to the people of South Africa, who are on every TV program that comes up, they're there, they say, please watch it, more rain's coming, the rain's going to fall in this area, but those people living next to the Black River, next to the White River, I mean, our communication and our ideas of trying to tell our people. So we may have good systems, but the way that we communicate, I must tell you, the last floods and stuff, I was expecting when the Weather Bureau, with all this great information they have, comes up, that there's a person there every time when the Weather Bureau comes up and says, we are giving you a strong warning from Department of whatever. We are saying to you that this is where this is going to happen. More water is being released in the Vaal Dam. More water has fallen in the Lesotho Islands. It's going to flow through across the wall of the Gariep Dam, and it's going to, and you people in Douglas must wait. There's big floods coming. You know, I get out, get out, move, run. Now, you know what I'm saying is, You know, I must tell you, and I'm not a big fan of what the Americans always do, but there are some things that they do well. Communicating issues and cases like this, there must be a face within the Home Affairs and a face within Water Affairs, that if we see them in the street, they will be more familiar than Shah Rukh Khan in India, the movie star. That when you look at him, you say, we know that's Mr. Weatherman. He's going to... You know, I'm serious about this. If we do not as a government, we have things. So please, the issue of communication, I don't know how I'll read through the paper still. I haven't fully gone through it. But I want it to be much more in a place. Just as important as monitoring is. The issue of communication, of information, is vital. And I want us to, as departments, you know, Mr. Morgan says this, and I agree with him a lot of times, when most of the, every time he said this, is you have to, sorry, I don't know why I'm mixing it up, it's a very important point. You have to be the leaders. On, you know, you climate change. The government has given you the role to be the leaders. So you have to lead. There has to be people that are communicating to us and telling us. So I'm making a long general point because I it's something I'm jotting down, and I want to see this reflected more strongly, is how we communicate and what structures we put in place to communicate to our people. Because as you said, the issue of climate change, the one thing we can be certain of, we may not always, the one thing we can be certain of, it's probably going to get more of these and more often.
Absolutely.
So what it becomes more important to us? It is how we're going to communicate this to our people, particularly remembering it's poor people. The best only access they probably have is a radio from time to time. So I really want this to become a much more focused part, is how you become the leaders around climate change, and particularly in communicating this. It's a general point I want us to be much stronger on. Okay. Any other issues, Dr. Wong?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's for the Parliament, I still need for the more information, because you say that before the 11th of February, 16 hours, where we received the public comment. I don't know if how many comments that you already received, because now it's the 11th of February already passed. So regarding to the Chairperson and other colleagues' comment, this regarding the public, very important for majority, they don't understand for this green paper draft. Even sit inside the house with the member, we stole the very hard reading for this old document. And depending to your department, where the leader for this climate change, and especially for the end of this year, we're hosting this conference. So I think it's also the many of the process will be followed after public hearing. So I think it's Chairperson, I fully agree for the your comments, because this one is very important. We need it from the public, not only for house these 20 people sitting inside discussing for this lawmaker for this climate change. So I need more information. How many is already commented in your department? Thank you.
Just remember there are two processes. One is our process. The deadline was the 15th of February, and one or two people gave after that. I've accepted it. And then there's another process with deadlines, which was the 11th of February, which is the department's process. So in answering that, just remember. Ours, of course, we're dealing with separately. Any other issues? Those are the questions for this part. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I'll start off with the communication thing. One of the things that was actually on the agenda is to start presenting to you how far we've come, because we have taken you incredibly serious, and there is the beginning.
You will be the first ever to have taken me seriously.
I'm
ecstatic about that.
Chair, you would have seen it from your list of actions of 21 that came from our engagement in January. So we are acting on all of those 21 instructions, and the climate change leadership in climate change, and specifically the communication, is one of that, and I think we've taken all the suggestions around industrial roadshows, industrial theatre, using our community radio stations more. All of that, the beginnings of that is there. We do have a costing challenge, and we are starting to talk to industry to help us to fund it. And I think we have good news specifically from the communications industry, where we start to get sponsorship for some of these community outreach work specifically around climate. So if we have time, we can still let Mr. Modisi do the communication. I think there are also things in the green paper itself around communication and awareness and messaging that we need to add onto that. But I think the plan is starting to come together, and we are certainly taking it very, very seriously. I will ask Peter to... Albie, I don't know if you want to add to that, but I will ask Peter to respond to...
I will give you time to give that input. There will be space.
In terms of the working with the other departments, I think we had... in the beginning quite a rough ride with specifically the other departments and bringing the other departments on board, but as Mr. Lukia has indicated, this is government's policy. We are the coordinators and the facilitators, so the work that you see in the policy on water comes from water, and it comes from the champion in water, and so we've got that original document that was X 165 or whatever pages long, and they provided us with a sector input into it that we then facilitated to be that succinct input. Peter, I don't know if you want to talk to the other questions, which was just to remind you the status of the white paper, the role of the white paper in the COP process, the implementation of the white paper, the possibility of climate change legislation, what happened with the other major differences, the energy mix, specifically nuclear and the financial mechanisms, what are our monitoring and evaluation plans, specifically are we compiling a database, we've talked about the communication, and then the whole issue around disaster management.
Thank you. Chair, all exceptionally important points. I think that just to reiterate what the CEO said is that the department has put together inputs from other departments. So, for example, the kind of provincial roadshow we've done around the green paper is based on 4 or 5 years of departments within their own constituencies doing work as well. So, for instance, the Department of Agriculture's submissions around climate change have been based on their work in rural areas with smaller communities and subsistence farmers as well. I mean, we've not invented anything here. This is based, we've taken stuff that's been given to us based on many, many years of discussions and what have you, as you've seen from the actual process. And we've tried to weld it into something that makes sense. That does not mean, and you're absolutely correct, is that we're not speaking to every single person in the country. It's just absolutely not true. We would never be in the situation where we even admit to say anything near that. And that's the reality. So your point around communication and outreach is fundamentally important. I think climate change, and we all agree, I mean, this is around behavior change. And we're not an autocracy. You know, behavior change we could easily make through an autocracy. And that's why, you know, often we have situations of saying, well, China's doing exceptionally well. You know, it's easier in that sort of situation. Democratic systems are a little more complicated in terms of actually looking at behavior change. So within that, I mean, the whole aspect of our outreach, and certainly from a governance point of view, is that it is so much easier as government if people actually change rather than forcing them to change through legislation or anything else. So that really has to be one of the most important strategies that we ever use. The members will be interested to know that in terms of outreach structures and participatory approach around climate change, in fact, one of the oldest standing stakeholder structures in government, I believe, is the National Climate Change Committee, the NCCC. It was formed in 1994, straight after democracy, and it's been in existence since then. It's had 156 meetings. And it's a stakeholder forum made of government and civil society. And civil society is balanced in terms of NGOs, CBOs, labor, business and industry, and the academic community. And it's been running continuously throughout. It's also used as a forum for South Africa to talk about our negotiating position and so on and so forth. Highly democratic forum. It's become more of a reference group than it was before. In the early days of democracy, it was very, very much almost an activist type situation about how South Africa should react. But now it's become very much a reference group to put forward government's position and to get the kind of responses that we get from normal civil society. But with that, we have the Intergovernmental Coordination Committee. And that is a committee that's also had a long, long standing. It was resuscitated again 2 years ago because it's sort of falling into disuse because the NCCC was used as the vehicle. But that is now up and running very, very effectively. And it really is the vehicle that we use for coordination. So we chair that. We go through all the key sector departments are represented there, and normally at a relatively senior level. And if they're not, we said they need to be. And we kind of crack the whip around inputs and what have you. We've, as the COO said, it's sometimes like pulling teeth from certain departments, and I won't mention names, but I mean, there's some departments which don't see climate change as really being their bag. But I think in this process itself, that's really been a good thing, is because suddenly when we've gone through with the science and sort of said, we've got very little response from you, but the science says there's going to be major impacts in your sector. And yet your sister departments are doing so much work, what are you doing? And it's actually been a very interesting process of actually drawing information out of those departments as well. So within that, once again, we've taken these massive amounts of inputs and try to weld them into the same kind of document so there is some sort of level of alignment. But they're not ours. We've not made these things up. And hence that's been one of the criticisms as well, is the level of detail between sectors. In some instances, for example, the sector that falls within our jurisdiction, which is waste, we've got targets and things about how we're going to do with waste and composting and what have you, whereas the same level of detail isn't applicable to somebody who has far greater emissions, for example. And so there is something that we're going to have to come to grips with in terms of the balance of the sectoral balance, I think, in terms of detail. The aspect about the other government I've covered through the Intergovernmental Committee, very, very strong. And of course, the Intergovernmental Committee itself reports to an interministerial committee as well. So we have an IMC that is established some time ago and runs. To reiterate, once again, it's this policy is not the department's policy, so we are not going to hold any other government department to account. This is government's policy. It's been an interesting point, though, that has come through the public discussions and the provincial workshops, is saying, who is accountable? Mm-hmm. Who do we take to account? And the reality, of course, is that, for instance, if a department is responsible for building houses, they will still be responsible for building houses. And they're supposed to do it in terms of government's policy. And so, therefore, they would still be accountable. And if they're not accountable, then you'd go through the usual parliamentary processes. So there's no new structures here.
There will be an accountability.
Absolutely.
Insofar as you are coordinating and managing. I mean, you can't sit back. Look, I mean, if things are not happening in housing, you can't sit back and say, well, you know, go and ask housing. So there is a new accountability in the sense that government has put you, and I say you, I mean your department, at the heart of coordinating and managing the possible policy. And your number 9, which is monitoring, I mean, you're going to become unpopular.
Oh, and there's no doubt.
Because you're going to be the one that every year is going to have to give a report to the Interministerial Committee, who's going to give the report to Cabinet.
That's
to
true.
Say, in terms of housing, we've now said that they're going to have to put these kind of geezers in. They're not doing it. They still, you know. In terms of water, we've asked them to use this kind of stuff. They're not doing it. So, you know, you're going to be the one that reports that. So there is, of course, as you quite rightly say, each department is going to be responsible for theirs. But in terms of the overall policy and its management, and it being the standard to which we hold government, that's why we're adopting it. Government adopts it,
no.
And we in Parliament approve it. That becomes the standard to which we hold government.
Absolutely.
We can expect them what is in there to comply with it.
Yes.
I mean, there is a slight addition to accountability that is brought about, and that is the monitoring and management of the policy.
Absolutely.
So I think we just should add that, because otherwise it looks as if it's just business as usual.
Yes.
Each department's going to do what they want to, but just in terms of the policy.
No, no. Absolutely correct, Chair. Then in terms of the aspect around legislation, the policy itself already intimates that we're going to be using existing legislation where we can. So, for example, around mitigation, the Air Quality Act already has provisions for making interventions. And the policy gives a very interesting idea that, for instance, what we'll do is we'll actually, through the Act, make greenhouse gases priority pollutants. And as soon as we declare them as priority pollutants, then we can actually then require significant emitters of greenhouse gases to then produce pollution reduction plans, which are then approved by the Minister for Implementation. So there are already regulatory mechanisms for us to actually implement certain elements of the policy. But once again, in terms of, for instance, whether there's going to be an omnibus climate change act, for example, I can't say whether that's required. Certainly from our side.
Open about it.
No, absolutely. I mean, we haven't closed our mind on this.
Because I mean, I think you're right in saying that you could deal with air pollution or deal with that act. Mm. But you must go and look at countries that have started legislating for departments like yours that have a management and coordinating function. Look at Britain and their criminal justice system. The way that they do, you can do it through protocols, where you try and bind the partners together, or you can actually give it a stronger way to do it through legislation. And the kind of climate change structures, national database, the structures that you would want to exist, the monitoring, those kind of things you may very much want in a piece of legislation. So not the substance of the detail of issues, but in terms of the how you set up your management and coordination.
Yes.
That's why I say keep an open mind.
Yeah. Chair, you're absolutely right. And actually, to come to one of your earlier points, the department and with the other departments through the Intergovernmental Committee creates a matrix of the various functions that are required under a climate change response and who's doing them. And so we had the national departments on the one axis and a whole bunch of the other functions across the other. And to a large extent, I mean, as I said, a lot of the stuff falls within the existing mandates for departments, except for one, which is the one that you brought up right earlier in the discussion, was this audit. The policy audit stuff. If a department is doing something, who is going to make sure that the climate change aspects of it are properly included? And that is a whole. We have no one's actually doing this overall auditing in terms of development of national policy. And that, of course, one would imagine that from the lead agent point of view, that would be one of the roles of the department, I'd imagine. Then, in terms of the aspects around the movement around the three.
So again, to add something, the problem with government is, or often with government, so your real problems lie with management coordination. There are some departments that are bad and they have problems, but usually departments at least are an upward curve generally. And they do their work and we can hold them to account. But your big problem comes with integration. And we, being a democracy only 17 years old, all democracies have natural systems in place which create it. Now the problem is we don't have those systems in our country. And the problem, that is why I'm saying you must look at legislation and protocols, because what happens is, if Luki, like Joanne goes now, she takes a whole lot of knowledge with her. You leave, you take a whole lot of knowledge with you. Ms. McCord leaves, she takes off. So all the institutional knowledge sits in the heads of people and not in the system that we so that the systems can actually. So if the next person comes in, they then start reinventing the wheel because there's not naturally systems in place in government. I mean, and as you have ministries changing politically, they change. As you have DGs changing, people changing. You have your problem is that your institutional knowledge gets lost all the time and has to regenerate itself. So if you don't look at creating specific institutions that you leave there your legacy, that when you go, it will be there for the next person to take further, you have big problems with it. So that is why I'm saying we must be much stronger on these things. Because you are the managing and coordinating body within government, you have to start looking at ways, other than just these committees that exist now that are going to help you with your work. They're not going to help you integrate the work. They're not going to help you monitoring the work. They're not going to be able to monitor be the sharp edge of getting people to do certain things. Therefore, you have to create other things to do that. And I really think that this area, we must really flag it. The whole area of number 9, the monitoring, plus the systems that we create with that to make this thing work. Otherwise, there's two problems you're going to have. When individuals leave, you're going to have gaps. And number 2, you're not going to have teeth your money. In fact, I said the same thing to the deputy minister when it came to the growth issues, which again, they're fulfilling a monitoring coordinating function. If you don't tighten those things up, they're not going to work in the end of it. Okay, before you move to the next question, I imagine these two issues are reflecting on what I've just raised, Mr. Morgan.
Yes, Chair, and actually not really directed at Mr. Lukey, but just something for us to flag as a committee, and it relates directly to the areas of the systems and the monitoring and the responsibilities, and it's something I know you and I have chatted about before. But equally, when we review the Green Paper in Parliament, we should begin that process of how, as an institution, we are going to monitor climate change as a parliamentary institution, because of exactly the things that Mr. Lukey has said. Well, it's very clear. Well, I want it very clear. I mean, it's being presented that there's a certain roles and responsibilities of all departments, and then there's a possible gap with, well, who's going to check and monitor everyone is doing their job, and we may very well come up with the same problems as a parliamentary portfolio committee. I would like to think, of course, that this committee would like to take the lead on it, and I certainly hope we do, but we can't very easily go about, possibly we can, but we certainly won't be able to do it very easily, interrogating other departments. So it's something to flag and something I'd like to see us, you know, work on more. Thanks, Chair.
No, that's correct. I mean, we're going to have to find ways to interact with those committees to make sure that they're doing. Once this white paper has been approved, then we have teeth. So it's difficult now to do it, but once you've got it, then you can start. And then we'll look at how we do it in Parliament. But at this stage, in any case, this committee, as far as I'm concerned, very much is in the forefront of this coordination. And we need to make sure that our department is doing what they have to. Mr. Grayler?
Yeah, I mean, my point was almost exactly the same. I mean, I think that we need to, as parliamentary, look at our systems of accountability in terms of this white paper, or what will ultimately be a white paper. I mean, I sit on the Energy Committee as well, and just going through the list of commitments in the energy sector, I mean, I've got a list here that I can certainly go to the department and say, have you implemented? I mean, I know they haven't implemented a lot of this. So it gives me a lot of teeth as a parliamentarian, and perhaps we should be looking at empowering other MPs on other committees to say, please check on these things and hold them accountable to that. Because you talked about systems of accountability, and hopefully Parliament can be the kind of ultimate system of accountability where we really interrogate what departments are doing.
Chief, on this issue as well, I think something that we have to mind as a department when, you know, putting our minds on this is the role that Outcome 10 and specifically the monitoring and evaluation role with the presidency plays in this regard, because the Green Paper and the whole policy process and the implementation of the policy is in the Outcome 10 delivery agreement that was signed by the sector departments and ministers that play a role in the implementation thereof. So I think I think we need to tighten it, but we need to bear that in mind when we respond to this.
No, that's right, but you see also, if one goes and looks at those performance agreements and all those things, have they factored it in terms of the creation, their role in the creation of a green economy? I mean, is it part of their performance? And I assume it's not going to be. So it's a learning process we have to go through, and we have to draw these things in, create those mechanisms. The thing at the end of the day, the simple answer really that I'm just trying to make is this. When Johnny DeLange leaves this committee, then someone else must be able to step in here, and there must be systems in place to be able to continue exactly what we've done. And the same with the department. If Lukey goes, then the next person that steps in there must be able to take it and know that this is what I do. This is my job. And this is how I am now fulfill the white paper function. For that, you have to put systems in place. And there are different ways of doing it, but I'm a very strong systems person myself. I believe in it very strongly. Because if you want to leave a legacy in serving the public, the legacy you leave in place is a proper functioning structure. You don't take everything that's in your head and you move out. You take what's in your head, but you leave behind a proper functioning system. And that's what I want to try and get through to our two departments in this term of ours, is that it's important for us to, our legacy as a department, as a committee, has to be to leave those structures here for the next people to be able to fulfill their part and do it better and improve on it. Okay? So that's just the point. But I want to make it a focus point in the white paper as well. Under that monitoring section there, we need to say a bit more about how we're going to do these things. Because then you start getting my attention. Because you can always, each sector can always change as we go along. But in terms of the systems you place to get that to work, that's very important. Okay, next question.
Sure. Then the next question that are on place was you asked about whether there had been any movement in terms of the three areas where there was no consensus at the summit. The first one around the energy mix itself is that, well, there has been quite dramatic movement. I mean, the IRP clearly shows nuclear as a part of the South African energy mix. But the energy mix itself is also, in the integrated resource plan, has changed quite dramatically. And although, for instance, we may not see that as being hugely ambitious, if one considers the way the business-as-usual approach, it is a massive change from the business-as-usual approach. And I think it's also important to note, Chair, as well, is that I've been involved in this development of this process now for some years, and it is quite astonishing what has been achieved in a relatively short period of time in terms of the way people perceive things. Some of the things that we put forward now as just being common knowledge were hotly debated as little as 2 years ago as being pie in the sky, impossible to do. Those things are no longer that way. So there's been quite a dramatic shift. So from the 2009 summit, there's already been a dramatic shift. I mean, there have been summits on the green economy, which was never even envisaged at that particular time. So the energy mix thing on its one hand has been kind of addressed, and it's also, as I said, the real lobby around there is the anti-nuclear movement. And the reality, once again, is that if nuclear appears in any description of the South African energy mix, they will oppose it. So therefore, you'll never get consensus on that issue. And so we understand that. On the other aspect of the energy planning aspect, of course, we've now gone through an energy planning process, which may, once again, as in any planning process, may not be perfect, but it's certainly seen as far more transparent than in the past. And so that in itself is seen as process, as progress. There also appears to be good feedback around the integrated energy planning, which is beyond electricity, it's looking at our entire energy resource. And there's a feeling that process itself is also a good process that is moving forward. I can't, of course, talk on behalf of another department, but certainly the feedback that is coming to us seems that there's been movement since the 2009 thing and in the positive direction. Then on the aspect of what type of economic instruments we're going to be using to price carbon, there's been a lot of movement. There's been research done through NEDLAC, which has basically come through and sort of said, in terms of carbon trading in the country, in a country like South Africa that actually has a profile where our two chief emitters of greenhouse gases, our biggest industrial sources, basically Eskom and Sasol, it means that trading would be done between those two sources if it's done locally, which doesn't make any sense at all. So in the short term, the whole aspect of internal carbon trading as an economic instrument is not seen as a viable alternative. So there's been independent research that confirms this. The other important step forward is that Treasury has released a discussion document with a very well-argued position about how they intend to look at the pricing of carbon. And to be honest, Chair, having Treasury release a discussion document on a tax is quite revolutionary. I mean, Treasury is not known to actually discuss what they're going to do with taxes. You know, in many instances, for instance, when Treasury announced the first, what we can call a carbon tax, which is the levy on electricity from fossil fuel sources, many people sort of said, well, did the Department of Environment feed that into Treasury? The honest answer was no. Treasury came up with that. That was their idea. So Treasury is not normally known for its participatory process around tax. And you can understand that for the obvious reason is that no matter what you do, no one likes tax. So you can never go to a public participatory forum and expect a whole caucus of people to sort of say, give us more tax. So I can understand their point of view. So their release of this discussion document to actually start getting some real debate around the use of economic instruments is seen as a massive progress forward. So of the three issues that were raised in 2009, from a process point of view, there's been a lot more information, a lot more stuff out there, and the debates have progressed quite a long way. So we've dealt with almost all three. It doesn't mean that they're not, that's, for instance, the anti-nuclear movement is now suddenly the pro-nuclear movement, and they simply are not. Then in terms of national databases, like you, Chair, I'm a systems person. I come from an engineering background, and I believe that that's the sustainability of a process is the systems that you leave behind. And with that, the national database on inventories, the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory, has been a once-off consultancy-driven process. We basically employed consultants every 4 or 5 years. We go out and do a process, get the data together, and then we have the inventory. That is not seen as sustainable in any way. We're now in the process of developing the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory, which will then be regulated through law. So in other words, if you're a significant emitter of greenhouse gases, you'll be required to mandatorily report your emissions to a web-based system. The web-based system is already under development as part of the South African Air Quality Information System, and it's part of the entire National Atmospheric Emissions Inventory System, which not only looks at greenhouse gases, but all the criteria pollutants as well. So within 2 years' time, we will be having a situation with at least piloted with significant emitters that will provide us hands-on information of exactly what our greenhouse gas profile is, and every 6 months we'll be able to actually measure how we're doing in terms of our responses.
But I think what I'm talking about is we have to go further on this.
No, absolutely.
We have to, in the department,
absolutely.
Create a national database that collects this, even if it's done elsewhere, collects the information from the Weather Bureau, from the fisheries,
absolutely,
from wherever, and then in your, whatever you think must be in that database, you put it in there, and then you have an analytical capacity in the department.
Mm.
They can then use it and start then being able to generate that.
Absolutely.
So I'm really talking about Ms. McCord.
No.
This one. If you want to make an old man God happy, don't fall in love with me. Give me a database.
So, Chair, with
easy pleasures in this way.
Chair, with that, and apart from your pleasure, of course, I mean, and at your pleasure. I mean, of course, it's a really important one as well, but I also want to bring to your attention a very, very important data tool that's being developed, and it doesn't fall within this department. It falls in the Department of Science and Technology. It's called the South African Risk and Vulnerability Atlas. Now, this is a database which is a live database, which is probably one of the most important planning tools that we're going to keep running as government, because the reality is that municipalities have to plan, and in order to plan around climate change, they have to know what their vulnerability is. And apart from the obvious ones, which sort of say that perhaps Johannesburg does not have to complain or plan around sea level rise, although that may change. But the reality is that they do need to know is where they must put their resources. Are they vulnerable to floods? Are they vulnerable to decreased rainfall and what have you? The South African Risk and Vulnerability Atlas is providing municipalities with that information now. But it's tough. It is not easy. Through the second national communications and the information that we got, we had a situation where data from one town showed that there was an increase in rainfall, and 80 kilometers away another town showed a massive decrease in rainfall. So that kind of disparity in terms of trends is really, really difficult to capture. In the policy, we make it quite clear that one of the things that we need to do from an information perspective is to downscale our models. Because at the moment, our models are based very much on its overall impact on South Africa. But that doesn't really help a municipality out in some deep rural area about what it should spend its very limited budget on. And so through this Risk and Vulnerability Atlas, we're hoping that over time we'll be able to start providing them with really, really good planning information of where they should spend their resources. And I think, Chair, that's... There's one more element in terms of the questions as well, and it speaks to your outreach aspect as well. One of the things that we found around the climate change outreach, specifically at grassroots level and specifically where people have already built up a resilience to change, is through the work that that NGOs do. And in the climate change issues, we've seen an area of NGOs that has not emerged before that is exceptionally strong around climate change, and those are faith-based organizations. There is a very, very large movement within the religious sector, and it's not Christian or whatever, it's the faith-based communities that are looking very, very strongly at this. And it comes down within the Christian sector, for example, there's a whole movement around the integrity of God's creation and seeing climate change as a major threat to the integrity of God's creation. So within the church sector as well, as a social outreach phenomenon, we've seen a huge amount of involvement from the faith-based community. And in actual fact, the faith-based community is mentioned in policy, which has been questioned in the provincial workshops of why a government policy should even mention faith-based organizations. Absolutely. You know, and somebody, tongue-in-cheek, of course, would have said, surely we must keep the separation of church and state. But the interesting thing is that the faith-based community themselves has said, we want to see us reflected in there because we as social partners have a role to play in this climate change.
As long as our solutions don't, the only solution we then have is let's pray. That's an easy way for the partners to get around their task. Our solution is let's pray, brother. No, I think, in fact, there's two submissions we will hear on the Thursday. It's a group of them, and then it's the South African Council of Churches.
Yes.
They have made submissions, so we'll hear from their perspective. We'll open with a prayer.
Just to add on my understanding of what you're saying, both in terms of the database and the systems and structures, is that in the database and in the system that we establish around the implementation of the Green Paper, we need to look at data and information management, we need to look at monitoring and evaluation, and we need to look at coordination and integration. And I think monitoring, evaluation, auditing,
analysis.
Yeah. So I think these databases that Peter referred to would probably be reflected in an overarching database of the policy.
Let me give you an example. If you go to the criminal justice system, which is the one I understand, a lot of information is collected.
Yeah.
The health department that deals with rapes and so on, they collect data. The social development that deal with children that are abused and that they collect data. Then the police, within the police, there's a whole lot of different units that collect data. Then within the prosecuting authority, there's a whole lot of data collected. The courts, there's a lot of data collected. The problem is, no one has ever tried to pull it together. No one has ever said, wait, but shouldn't we pull all this? You know, the criminal justice system is like a pipe. So if something happens here, it affects there. So shouldn't we actually collect all this information, create one database? Now your problem's on. You have legislation and government. You have each department, and sometimes within a department, who use different software. So they don't talk to each other. So they can't use each other's software other than giving them a hard copy. So that's what I'm talking about, is that information that will affect in all different departments. You must now create a mechanism where you pull this information together. They can download it for you. You get one system that, for you, the first thing to do is go and identify what is all the information we need. That's the first thing. It's a hell of a job to sit down and say, you know, for us, for in terms of the temperature rising, this is the data we need. In terms of rainfall, this is the way. In terms of floods, this is the information. In terms of fish. In terms of whatever. There's some very interesting stories how climate change affects animals and their behavior and all those kind of things. Now, you know, if you want to collect all that, you're not necessarily going to, what you have to identify is where is this information. If it isn't anywhere, then you have to create a database to collect that, or get a department that's relevant to agree to collect that information. Then you start pulling all that together in one system, and then you create the analytical capacity to analyze it. That's really what one's talking about. Then, of course, that fits into that is monitoring, all the other stuff that goes with it. You know? So I think that's really what I'm... It's a huge job, but it's a job that actually every sector where there's a coordination management in government should have.
Absolutely.
It should have them. Sorry, I interrupted you, Ms. McCall. Do you want to go ahead?
That's absolutely fine. I think we are currently looking at the, you know, we've done the climate branch as a short-term structure, but we are in the process of looking at it again, and this is an area that has been identified as an area which there is expand its capacity in this. So currently we have three streams, which is the adaptation, mitigation, and international. And it has already been mentioned that the whole research, development, monitoring, and evaluation needs to be another focus when we look at the strategy of the structure of the climate change. I think the two issues that Peter didn't respond to, Peter, relates to the status of the white paper in the COP17 process. I think that's the one issue that's still outstanding. What would it be used for in the COP17 situation?
So on that, as with any national policy, I mean, it uses leverage. And we've, of course, been benchmarking against other... Absolutely. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, there has been, in discussion through the provincial workshops, people sort of said, well, why are we doing it now? Surely we want to keep our powder dry, have the draft green paper sitting there unfinished, but kind of with some interesting little dangly bits and promises and what have you, and then wait for the COP, you know, just to say, well, we're thinking about this, or we're thinking about that. And of course that would be a negotiating strategy. However, it's probably not a wise one. I think the sort of situation is actually to put your, you know, we've absolutely, and I think in this sort of situation we've compared our climate change policy with others, and although ours is a bit more difficult in that we actually have to do this adaptation mitigation balance, the only other more progressive kind of policies that we come across are those being the small island states who are responsible for no greenhouse gas emissions, and basically their entire islands are disappearing under their feet. And so of course they can say strong things about what they need to do. So within the thing, I'm hoping that by the end of it we'll actually have a strong document that is quite clear about our international commitment. And as the host of COP17, I think our policy is good leverage to actually show our integrity in the matter as an honest broker for an international deal. And I think that's the standing of it, I think.
That's a difficult one. You see, if you go to these negotiations and you went to Europe, the EU are the most progressive on these issues, but they've got no charter because they've already committed themselves in their parliament, targets and so on. So there's nothing to say, you can't say anything to America or Canada or someone say, well, now we're going to hold back. Because everyone knows they've made these policies there. So it is a two-cutting sword. But, you know, I must say, if you ask where I want us to lead on this and to be progressive on this, if we're going to sit back and wait for every country to tell us first what they've got before we say we'll commit us to something, then how are you a leader in that field? I mean, I don't regard the countries that have stayed out of this. They may think they are leaders on the issue. I don't regard them as leaders on it. I truly regard the EU as a very strong leader on this issue. Because they have committed themselves. They've committed their countries on these issues. They've gone far beyond it. I mean, if you saw the latest report we heard at Cancun, they've gone far beyond some of the things they promised. So on the one hand, that weakens them. Because they can't threaten anyone. They can't say, well, we're going to walk out with the kind of biggest economy or a joint economy. They can't walk out of it. But at least what they're doing is leading on the issue. And in that sense, it gives them the moral high ground. And in terms of the rest of the world, like us, looking at them, I definitely take my leadership from the EU and not from those countries that are sitting outside and doing their own thing. I mean, and so I think it's a two-cutting-edge sword. You can decide, you sit on the fence, wait for everyone else, and in that way you don't have to do anything. But in the meantime, what we're doing is that we're not honest with our people, we're not being morally doing the correct things, and then somehow along the line, it's going to start catching up. Then you're going to have to really move quick, you're going to cost extra, whereas if you do it over a process and a period, it seems to me the lesser of the two evils. And I do think that we should encourage government to keep, well, it's the policies and it's gone in that direction. I think it's definitely the right way to go. Mr. Krem?
Yeah. I'm just on that point. I mean, I'm wondering, to what extent this could be an iterative process. I mean, could we come back and review after COP17 I mean, does it leave open some space for us to actually commit to things which might not be in the white paper at the moment? And so we would come back and revise that. I mean, that's on the kind of negative side of it. But the positive side is that perhaps we would also see a greater flow of funds. And perhaps if we could then increase some of our commitments based on the fact that we might have more funds flowing into those sectors. So we could increase, for instance, the renewable energy sector, things like that. I'm just interested to what extent this will be cast in stone or to what extent we can revisit some of these after the COP as well.
Chair, in response, the entire sector is highly volatile. We don't have a decent international agreement. Once we do receive a good, positive international agreement, our policy could be out of sync with that. We're going to have to look at it. So I would imagine that with anything like of a nature that is so volatile and so dependent on international things, we're going to have a situation where we can't say that, for instance, this is it, this is our policy for the next 5 years. And within the policy itself, I think there should be a process of review. And we can easily build that into the policy, I think. And I think it has to be there, simply because, I mean, because there are uncertainties, and the policy itself says we must take a risk-averse approach. So so I think the policy itself gives an indication that we need to actually be flexible in our response.
That's one possibility. The other one is that as we become more
efficient and we get our own database in place and we scientifically start seeing what is happening, we may in any case have to review this and become either stronger or weaker on certain issues because we're saying, you know, our policy as we agree to it, if we go that we're going to have disaster down the line. Because either this reason or that reason. So a policy is, of course, a binding instrument on government for that point in time. But, of course, it can change. I mean, if you take a good example, if you go and look at some of the white papers on water, I mean, some of those white papers are slowly, in some areas, being overtaken by events. So, you know, a white paper has to, you know, policies have to be renewed often, well, not often, but as circumstances change. And I would say, you know, every decade or so, you will find that in most areas of government, there are significant changes to possibly change some of your policies and so on, one way or the other. Even if it's only just population growth, think about it. I mean, as a factor, it's a huge one. All right. Now we're going to each sector. Let me just see what time it is. Okay, let's do one sector at a time. And let's see how much time we can do. The more we do now, the less we have to do on Thursday afternoon when people want to go home. So let's start with the water.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, water is the first sector that's detailed in the Green Paper. But it's also a sector that has come up for a bit of criticism by, interestingly enough, within the cabinet cluster itself. And you can see it from the first one. It basically says that one of the things that we as South Africa will do is good water management systems and institutions and accountable catchment management agencies. Now, what the ministers have said is that they're saying this policy should not be used to reiterate what government should be doing anyway. And it's an interesting point. I mean, in terms of, for instance, accountable catchment management agencies are directly required in terms of the Water Act to actually have that. So to reiterate what is already supposed to happen is not seen as a good way of dealing with policy. If, for instance, we need to accelerate the implementation of certain elements of legislation and existing policies, then that's what we need to highlight. And I think that's been one of the things that has been coming through, is just saying do not reiterate what is required. If there's a need to accelerate or to slow down or to broaden the focus of or what have you, that's what must be put in the policy. But here we have a typical example. Key adaptation sector, invest in monitoring capabilities, optimize the reuse of water. Once again, none of this is rocket science. You'll find in most of the stuff around climate change response, it just makes good sense from a sustainable development point of view. Is that if you're a country that is rainwater poor, the whole idea of rainwater harvesting is a good one, whether there's climate change or not. So in many instances, one would argue that, for instance, we should be doing this anyway, and all the climate change policy is doing is actually highlighting and reiterating what we should do. Implement integrated water resource management planning. Explore desalination opportunities. vigorously enforce compliance with water quality standards to ensure that our water remains fit for use and that clean water is available for blending to dilute pollutants. Develop and roll out more effective support mechanisms to ensure that safe drinking water is available to all. Measurably improve the management and maintenance of existing systems and strengthen the foundation of professionalism that already exists. Once again, basic stuff around water. If we're losing a huge amount of purified water through leaks, fix the leaks. The amount of energy that we use in terms of purifying water is dramatic. And if, for instance, we then use this energy, have our carbon emissions associated with it, and then allow the water to leak away through faulty pipes, it just is insane. So in many of the instances, once again, there is no real rocket science here. One of the criticisms that has come through is sort of saying there doesn't seem to be any major discussion or debate around things like basic things like water storage. As you're aware, Chair, I mean, we store our water mostly in large, very shallow dams, which are hugely vulnerable to evaporation. And with increased evaporation, is this actually the best way of storing our water? And so there is some discussion, and it's very early stages as far as I can understand from the Department of Water Affairs, is the whole aspect of looking at aquifer recharge, basically pumping our water back underground, because of course then it's protected from evaporation. But I think there's a lot of work here, and it's not fully reflected in the kind of things we need to do. And hopefully through this process, we'll start getting some far more clear direction of what they need to be doing there. So that was water.
You see, the thing is, it worries me if that is what our white paper does. Because, I mean, what you're saying is correct. You're just repeating what those departments are doing. In some sense, it's correct. It seems to me what we may have to look at is start identifying those areas that we should be focusing on that have an effect on climate change. For example, do you know that the Department of Water Affairs budget for infrastructure has been increased, doubled? So they are now going to have to start looking at new projects, new dams to be built. Surely that is something that has to be discussed broadly. Because, I mean, for all the reasons you've said now, I mean, you know, where, if we're going to build dams in certain places, I mean, are there going to be shallow dams that go in the high evaporation? Are there going to be dams with deeper water there? Are there in areas where it's going to help with the kind of floods that we see now, for example? Is there a need for a dam below Douglas? So that water that flows from the two rivers down, actually there's something that catches it and doesn't create this kind of... I don't know. Is there a need for dams in Transkei? For the development capacity in the Transkei, there are no dams there. So, if there's a double budget, if the budget's been doubled, then surely the Department of Water are soon going to make major decisions on where dams have to be built to spend that double budget. Because all the old budgets are used for maintaining present dams. What are the criteria we're going to use to build those dams? Is the criteria only going to be that it's mostly now to build it where Eskom wants us to build dams so water's available for there? That's a very important thing to do that.
Absolutely.
But do we then, you know, Eskom makes a decision to build these dirty things that make electricity, whatever they're called. with coal, therefore huge amounts of water are needed, or, you know, so what I'm trying to say is, I haven't read this paper properly, but immediately I'm kind of thinking to myself, we're back at the old kind of cluster thing. Each department says what they do, and then there's no real intervention, there's no integration. I may be wrong with it. If I read it properly, it may be different, but from the input, that kind of thing worries me. Now, what that really means is those departments then have to identify and put more clearly in this paper those areas where it is cross-cutting and it could be impacting, and where there are more than one decision needed to make that thing happen. I immediately have a nervousness about this. Not that anything is wrong with it. But that where it's going to lead us is to take us nowhere any further from where we are now in terms of integrating and so on. Yeah. So I make that point up front. I want you to note it probably for all the inputs. Mr. Schwelen?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. I mean, one point which I don't see mentioned explicitly here, maybe it's something which we do in the water sector anyway, but I mean, I imagine climate change will exacerbate it. That, I mean, water is going to be probably our biggest constraint to further development. And so I suppose choices over what type of developments are approved needs to explicitly be mentioned, that we're going to actually have to look at not only management of water, but industrial decisions, any kind of development decisions taking into account the water resources of that particular area. And I think that possibly, you know, water planning and those kinds of things needs to be mentioned there. The second point is that I haven't really picked up an explicit use of energy efficient, water efficient technologies. And so there's not talk about how every development should be forced to implement water efficient technologies, such as grey water systems in apartments or in houses, things like that. I mean, I think that we need to start to get more serious about how we either subsidize it or mandatory force these types of technologies out there. I'm just very interested to hear your comments on that.
Any further questions? Mr. Morgan? The department doesn't ask questions, you respond.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Lukey. On this particular issue, I think you made a very apt point that departments have to do certain things anyway, and granted the green paper is a good time. I mean, you can remind departments what they're supposed to be doing, but in many cases we're not reinventing the wheel. I mean, there's a lot of things that is really there. I would think that things which aren't explicitly in water law, which are also going to have to feature and are controversial, are, for example, things like the review of the pricing of water going forward. And of course it's a controversial thing. But to go with my colleague's comment, if we're going to, and we argued last week, we had this discussion with Deputy Minister Godongwana, which is very relevant to his new growth plan, but is equally relevant to climate change and being operating in an environment which is more constrained in terms of the ecological limits and the available resources, then, I mean, the mechanisms of water pricing are very useful for forcing efficiency going forward. And then just to reiterate the point which, you know, Mr. Chairperson De Lange made, the point of how, you know, certain things should be triggered over a period, like white papers, you know, don't end with one white paper, you can review them. Equally, the kind of planning process with water, I would imagine, under the conditions of a changing climate, it's going to have to be much like a gases inventory project which is permanently up and running and permanently reporting, actually. Because, I mean, the Water for Growth and Development strategy is an example, which there's a lot of stuff happening in the department, and some of it very good, some of it at your sister department. But the Water for Growth and Development strategy, in my personal opinion, is not a useful document anyway. It's kind of a literature review of water. But these kind of documents in the water resource strategy mustn't just be, you know, do it now and review it in a few years' time. They actually have to be live. And so much like we are able to say, well, who's emitting and whatever, the equivalent thing is, from an adaptation point of view, is actually who's using water in a very live sense, because it links, of course, and yeah, let's complete the circle. Dealing with climate change in an effective way is important for the sustainability of our economy. It's important for Minister Patel's growth path, and there's a circle there. And so I would certainly add that, as which I know things that you've probably considered, but which it's all about forcing the efficiency and knowing who's using what all the time, and not just reviewing it over periods.
Thank you, Chair.
The gentleman here, you wanted to answer something, or did you want to?
Banana to sort of, give you an overview about the fact that, besides the fact that, this green paper, we're also doing a parallel activity with land department. They are busy developing climate change adaptation sector plans. And some of the information, especially the water harvesting, water use efficiency, and so on, it has been flagged up. And it's just that maybe they need to incorporate that information in the green paper, the document.
Okay, that's useful to know.
Yeah.
That's useful.
Okay. Chair, on this, the approach that we've taken is that we, as a department, it's very difficult for us to defend inputs that have been given to us from other departments. But what we do is we actively feed back and we question, which is very much our role. And this water section has been an area where there's been a lot of comment. And I think the points that have been made are all absolutely correct. The whole sort of situation is that, we're a water poor country. We've had years and years of experience of how to actually look at water management and what have you. There has to be a kind of a business unusual approach to this. This is a new challenge, an extra challenge that has been faced to us, and it can't be a kind of a business as usual approach that we have to follow. And so therefore I think there is a challenge to the Department of Water Affairs to actually go back and sharpen their pencils on certain elements and have a look at them. And I certainly understand from my colleagues at Water Affairs that's exactly what's happening. That's why I found it quite difficult in terms of the early comments that came from the water units for saying that we ignore them. That's just completely not correct. We rely on them completely for their input. We don't make any of this stuff up. We challenge them and we just say, what are you doing about this? But the responses are really from the Department of Water Affairs and hopefully, and of course, all these things we feed back into the process. The aspects, of course, of water efficiency and water use efficiency have been a very strong push through the public provincial workshop processes, as have tariffs. Tariffs have been an interesting as well, and I think it's also important, and I know in this forum we must also be careful that we're doing we've completed these provincial workshops, and they have been used for before municipal elections as well, so they've also been used for grandstanding of certain positions too, which is difficult for us as officials to really unpack what is really just political grandstanding and not an actual comment on the green paper. But hopefully we've managed to separate the two. Some of them are very, very obvious and some of them are less obvious. But certainly within these sort of situations there's been strong talk about, for instance, how do we price what is a product, but a product that is completely necessary for life. You cannot survive without water. And so therefore, to price it correctly is a huge challenge. But once again, we would think that clever use of tariffs in terms of water use, what you do is you charge the people that use the most in the most wasteful fashion. The same kind of approach as we'd see for energy too. But so I think in response to these questions, what we've done is we take these points down. And there is no doubt that you will get the same kind of response, I believe, in your hearings too. And we'll take that information and we'll use that information to challenge those departments to say, you need to do more work here. It's obvious that you need to do more work here.
I think, look, that's very vital. Because I know how difficult it is to do this. You are coordinating the department. For you now to start saying, hey, do that. But maybe what you should start doing through these, your hearings and through these hearings, you start working out a template. If you can provide X information for waste, which you've done, these are your targets, then as a template, if out of these hearings it comes that is what you need, and I've looked at some of the submissions, that is exactly what people say, then what is the minimum template we would accept for people to put targets there? And what you then need is to get political buy-in for that through your minister, through the IMC.
Yes.
And then it needs to be made part of the white paper.
Absolutely.
To say we need this information from your department.
Absolutely.
The IMC has agreed. Therefore, this is the minimum information we need on targets. And so that you start getting a more balanced paper.
Absolutely.
Because if you're going to allow each department just to set what it wants to. And then the second issue that you have to do, and I'm not sure myself how one does this, and maybe one should do it through questioning, through questions and so on. Maybe there's a different way of doing it. But it's in each area to really identify which are those cross-cutting issues that need attention. As I said, the budget of the infrastructure budget of water is doubled, and in the next 3 years, it's a huge increase. Now, someone has to make decisions on how we're going to spend that and what we're going to do it, and what are we going to do with our water mix. And those decisions have to be made. Now, if you raise that in terms of questions at least, yeah, or at least to say, you know, these are, then the pricing thing. I mean, it's very, very vital to do that, because that affects, you know, how much water is available, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, because, and then the efficiency issues. When we say efficiency, and I've said everyone say efficiency, and I've heard rain harvesting and so on, but I mean, there's a simple thing, taps leaking. I mean, what are we going to do about that? Is there something we can do about it? I mean, do you say that all pipes that are older than 50 years have to be replaced? I mean, do you do a regulation like that? Yeah, you know, we have to start tackling some of these issues. It can't just be a summary of what we do. And we're going to provide clean water, we're going to provide adequate water. I mean, you know, I still can't get a picture, for example, of where we are with our water needs. Do we have X plus 5, plus 5 being the surplus we have at the moment, and the plus 5 can last us for X amount of time? I don't know. You know, surely a white paper that is actually looking at those things should at least say something on those stuff. Is that this is the amount of people we provide water to, 40 million, 45, 50 million people. This is the amount of water we have. At the moment, our water deficit or surplus is at this. For us to be able to provide for all the kind of things that impact on climate change, because we're not talking just about water policy, providing water. I don't want that in the paper. That's not necessary. Mm-hmm. But it's the kind of thing that impact on climate change. I mean, whether you build dams or not, what types of dams you build, where you build them, how you build them. I mean, that clearly seems to me to impact on what we say, et cetera. So I do think in each of these sectors, Mr. Luki, we're going to have to be a bit tougher. And it may be very well that you can come up with a template, as you've done with waste, to say at the very least we need this information in each sector, which we're going to put in the white paper. And as I said, then there's a process that, if that comes out of these hearings and so on, as I think it does when I look at the different submissions and what you've told me you've heard so far, then that becomes a very important point that we have to push. And you know, there's maybe need for that. Can we still, how long is agriculture? Can we fit it in a few minutes?
I'm sure we can, sir.
Okay, let's quickly hear agriculture.
Okay, so I think your point is just dramatically important, and certainly for me it would make my heart swell with joy if we can get the level of detail. But the simple reason is that your initial point about monitoring, it's so much easier to monitor if you've actually got real smart objectives. I mean, kind of fuzzy, you know, sort of fuzzy things like, for instance, we need increased improvement of capacity of so-and-so. It's very difficult to monitor, whereas actually tangible things is always easier. The other aspect of this, and it comes down to agriculture as well, because agriculture is the next sector, which of course is massively dependent on water as well. But the climate change thing as well is not around supply side stuff, really. Supply side, of course, is a huge thing. And if one looks at the energy side, I mean, the supply side is we have to find energy that is not as carbon intensive. But to a large extent, it's really around demand side. It's a case of we have been living beyond our means. That's what this climate change really says, is that we've actually been paying, we've been using capital which we just don't have. And now somebody's coming through and is calling in their markers. So on the water side, it cannot just be the supply side. It cannot be the building more dams and what have you. There has to be real and intensive work on the demand side, much the same way as we would do with energy. Simply because if we keep on wasting energy, we do, we'll be destroying huge amounts of landscape simply by having solar farms or wind farms or what have you. We shouldn't, that's the, you know, so within the whole situation, we have to start looking at the demand side on all the resource uses. And agriculture is much the same. There's some very, very interesting aspects that come through in the agriculture green paper, component of the green paper, because it starts speaking to things like, for instance, a move towards softer agricultural techniques, the no-till techniques and what have you, which of course are the things that we see as being very, very important anyway from any perspective. The other aspects that come through here strongly are the early warning systems. And within the early warning systems, and this has been an interesting aspect of the policy, is that it's not just an early warning system around rain, floods and droughts and what have you, but with floods and droughts and these extreme weather events normally comes pest outbreaks as well. And we don't actually have this sort of situation where we have this predictive capacity around, under these circumstances, what kind of pest outbreaks will we have and how to provide that information to farmers. So that's also, that's come out quite strongly in the agricultural situation. And so that's agriculture. Adaptation options. A lot of these are looking at our vulnerability atlas, where things are changing. And to a large extent, the agricultural sector can adapt. If, for instance, a farmer grows certain crops and it no longer is viable, they do switch. And so the agriculture is actually an advantage, a far bigger advantage than the biodiversity section, for instance, which is not being controlled. Yeah. So that's the situation. And the Department of Agriculture, I believe, is now also gearing up. I mean, a lot of the departments that have made these initial inputs have not stopped doing work, exactly as... Sylvester says, there's a whole bunch of increased attention now to sectoral response plans, where they've really started being inspired by this process, I think, and are now unpacking it. And we're starting to get a far more detailed and rich response to a lot of these things as the thinking improves. So there's agriculture.
Under each sector, have you, under each sector, specified what can be done for mitigation and what can be done for adaptation, or is that just going too far?
Chair, it's an interesting point because it has been brought up in the public discussions. There's been quite a strong push around the balance between adaptation and mitigation, and there's a trap that we must be very, very careful about that we don't fall into. Within our negotiating position as a developing country, we have been saying for many, many years about the balance between mitigation and adaptation for very good political reasons. It's because obviously the developing countries are more concentrating around the mitigation aspects because they normally have the money to actually do adaptation. It's the developing countries that have these massive poor populations that are so vulnerable. And so in the negotiations, we've had this whole aspect about the balance of mitigation and adaptation in terms of the kind of time and resources that are spent on those two issues. However, there is no balance between adaptation and mitigation. The one is a dependency on the other. If we don't mitigate, the amount of adaptation that we require is huge until eventually we cannot actually adapt out of the problem. So within that sort of situation, what we've tried to do is we've tried to sort of say the level of significance. And sure enough, agriculture is a source of greenhouse gas emissions, but not a dramatic one. So our concentration really has been on the adaptation side in terms of significance. Once again, we've had to prioritize in this sort of situation. There is no doubt that there is a potential for us to actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the agricultural sector. And certainly going through the organic route of farming, for example, would massively increase the capture of carbon. But we've not concentrated on that simply because of the need to prioritize.
Questions? Any questions?
I know it's also everything about climate change, and we started the conversation off like this today about accepting that climate change has cross-boundary impacts and the drivers of it are not always yourself, particularly if you do believe. And it strikes me that one of the things that needs to specifically be dealt with under agriculture is how South Africa fits into a sub-region with regards to food production. Because the Green Paper itself deals with, quite correctly, the fact that some areas the yields may increase and some areas the yields may decrease. And of course what we don't know yet, perhaps you do, but, and perhaps the agricultural sector has long-term projections, and I'm not necessarily expecting this level of detail, is how are we going to be on our ability to produce food, say, in 5 years' time, 10 years' time? Because one thing to say, up here, down here, the point is, what is our ability to produce calories overall? Some foods are better than others, and why I say the regional stuff is important with regards to agriculture is because over the entire SADC area, for example, you have a lot more land. It granted there are climate variabilities and changing climates everywhere, but food, and particularly the lack of food in the future, is another driver of instability. And, you know, granted we can control better what happens in our borders, and I think we produce about 90% of our own food, but how we get on and how we relate to our neighbours and fellow partners in the SADC, I think is very important for regional food security. Mm-hmm. And I just say, I mean, this is an absolute hypothetical. If we, for example, in 5, 10, 15, 30, 100 years are not going to be able to produce enough food in South Africa, will the higher rainfall areas of, and I'm presuming I'm correct, Mozambique and all the way along the east coast be able to satisfy, because they are underproducing at the moment, be able to satisfy the needs of a much larger area of land? And so in this section, you very much focused on South Africa. Mm. But it's the one thing where you don't project the what-if scenario, which I think you do need to include as a discussion point, at least in the Green Paper now.
Any last questions? All right, Mr. Lukey.
I would like to do correctly on the issue of the crop switching. What about them? Are you saying they are a good adaptation factor or what? If we can have an explanation about crop switching.
I'll certainly try to. In terms of the regional aspects and the regional food security aspects, I mean, I think these are really, really important points. The stuff that we've been getting through in terms of this particular aspect, I mean, has been that we've had some very interesting discussions around food security in general. And of course, not surprisingly, the whole aspect of, for instance, biofuels has come through into this debate as well. And in many instances, you've got the horrific comment, for instance, are we really still seriously contemplating, and the kind of jargonistic or jingoistic thing is, are we taking the food out of the mouths of poor people and putting it into the petrol tanks of the rich people? You know? And of course, that's a depressing thought, and it's something that really has to be taken into account. And so the whole aspect around agriculture and food production and food security is, I think, an exceptionally important one, especially in terms of looking at the fuel aspect as well. In terms of the crop switching aspect as well, this is a... We're already seeing these sort of situations. I mean, there are parts of the country that are now growing, that have vineyards, for example, and now have a small wine industry. They were never seen as suitable for wine before, and for some other reason now they are. We also have a sort of situation, for instance, where, and Guy will be able to talk much more about the impact of this, but things like, for instance, the required freezing cycle for fruits. As you may be aware, in order for some fruits to actually set fruit, they have to go through a period where there is a specific cycle of freezing periods or very cold weather. And if you don't have that cycle, then the fruit doesn't grow. And in some instances, we've had that sort of situation in areas where we've grown fruit for hundreds of years, and we've had to chemically induce that fruit to actually make it work, which of course means that you really have to start switching to other crops. There is another aspect that's been come out through the public hearings on this as well, is the whole aspect of, for instance, is the climate change policy, through its talk about crop switching and looking at varietals and what have you, is the climate change policy fully and strongly in support of genetically modified organisms, for example? As far as that's concerned, I mean, we're not getting involved in that. I mean, the Department of Agriculture is saying these sort of things. But certainly in terms of a lot of the stuff that's referred to here is not specifically GMOs as well. There are other techniques as well that are used in terms of actually doing crop-resistant varietals. is that you can actually graft very, very high yielding species onto drought resistant rootstock, and this is actually done very effectively in Botswana, and it's certainly something that we'd have to look at in South Africa. So those are the kind of issues that have come through. I mean, the food security issue has been a strong one, specifically from a regional perspective, and specifically from the competition for food for other uses. And the other thing is the whole aspect of GMOs.
Cool. Okay. Adam?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I now see why they sent the expert. I thought that your input this morning was excellent in making one understand the issues. I think it's going to take a bit of time for me. I know other people have been involved, but it's going to take a bit of time for me to get my head around some of this. My nervousness is that because of so many departments that we may be replacing the requirements of doing not necessarily what we want, but polishing the green paper to actually start changing some of those things. So I want people that know a bit more than I do about this to read through it and identify those questions. That doesn't mean we want I have no interest in a policy paper with fine detail. I'm not interested whether we're going to make sure that cows can have 4 calves a year, because if they have 4, then we, you know, they eat less grass and more grass, and that's going to help deforestation. You know, I'm not interested in detail like that. I am not. But I do think that those cross-cutting issues, I'm just already feeling that I can see there's a weakness, and it's in terms of a minimum threshold of target that we should expect. If we have a whole policy on monitoring and so on, you can't have a document that's quiet on those issues. I mean, I in any case thought we've adopted a policy that we're going to have after 25 years, we're going to peak and so on. Now, if you have that there, you have to ask each department how do they fit in that. I mean, if you don't, then it's just work. I mean, you know, you have to. Look, and I've been in government now for at least 17 years. I do understand that you don't meet all these targets all the time. But I mean, they have to be there, you know, so that you can see you haven't met them and then look at the reasons you haven't met them and see if you then can do something about it. Or in other areas, you move much faster and you go beyond the target. And that's great. But the fact of the matter is, if you have an overall, if you're telling the world, this is what we've agreed to, that we'll peak there, and then we'll start going down, then you have to then do the next thing. You have to put the blocks in place to meet that peak after 25 years? 2025. Actually, it's much less now. 2025. But I mean, whatever you do with that, you see, I think we should, if you want to have the moral high ground on these issues, you have to have it. Look, you can't, I'm told, medically, you can't be half pregnant. Well, I'm told. You're either pregnant or you're not pregnant. You cannot be half pregnant. It's a human impossibility.
Slightly pregnant.
So in our work we do, we should not be half pregnant. Because nature doesn't allow that. No, scientifically I'm told. You can either be pregnant or you're not pregnant. You cannot be in between. You cannot maybe be pregnant.
Slightly pregnant.
Or slightly pregnant. It's either it's happened and something's growing, or it hasn't happened and something's not growing. So I think, you know, I hope you understand what I'm saying.
Yes, I do.
Is I know the difficulty we have with dealing with a lot of problems, but what I'm asking you is to start looking at a template of what we expect to reflect under each sector.
Yeah.
And as I said, then we'll have to get political buy-in on that, but the point is that, you know, at the very least, that would be what would start arising out of these hearings for you to take forward. So that's very good. So tomorrow we'll continue with the two scientists. I think the department should be in any case, so if they finish quickly, these scientists, because I hear everything is consensus and there won't be problems and no questions. Give us the science of it. Then, of course, if there's more time, we'll continue with this. And then we'll continue with the whatever is left on Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock, okay? But we have to finish all this stuff by Thursday. So you must get your questions sorted out so we can finish by Thursday afternoon, okay? Thanks a lot. Can I just, you know, we also sent you a document from Globe. Each one of you, we send a copy, where they have two delegations coming here. The first delegation is here today. It's the Professor Lord Hunt, Fellow of the Royal Society. And he asked that if any members of the committee will meet him on Monday or Tuesday. So we sent this. They didn't ask us as a committee to organize. So I've sent it to each one of you. Please, if you can, try and get hold of them and see if you can see the person if you're interested. While he's here, today is probably the last day. And then Barry Gardner is coming around the time of the AWEPA and our hearings, and he's asked us to do a whole lot of stuff, but clearly all the things he's asked is during our hearings, so we're not going to be able to do anything in that period unless he changes it to the evenings or very early in the morning. But please be aware, for those people that do have a relationship with Globe and those, and even if you don't, these are interesting people to meet. They've done a lot of stuff. Okay, thank you very much. We'll see you. Oh, sorry, and the ANC members, three of you, could you, four of you, could please stay behind.
Okay, I believe it's there.
Okay, thank you very much.
They are stored with plates.
Okay.
You'll see them. There's the one. And the other.
Super. Thank you very much.
No, it's not. I'm about to put you back to the I'm on the
mat. Is that yours?
It is mine.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. This is a lunch.
No.